Do it again. That was great.
We are now recording.
All right, I'd like to call this meeting to order at 9:32, it looks like. Good morning, everyone. Appreciate you being here, and I just want to have a roll call, if we could, begin with that.
David Swartz.
Here.
Peter Leeds.
Present.
Paul Steron.
Here.
Aaron Green.
Present.
Michael Kolecka. We have a quorum.
Thank you. I wanted to just invite, we do have a public member here and perhaps some online, and just wanted to allow for a moment here to inform you that anything that you're here perhaps to speak about, we could not address it unless it's on the agenda. So if it's on the agenda, we'd like to have input, and if it's not, we could put it on a future agenda if you'd like to have that occur, and welcome to the meeting. So is there anybody who'd like to speak from the public on a matter that is not on the agenda, just to discuss putting it on a future agenda? Okay. Hearing nothing, we'll assume that anything that needs to be spoken of will be on the agenda. Thank you so much. Next item on is the adoption of the minutes from the prior meeting, which was set from September 14th, 2021.
I had technical issues, so I apologize. There's no computer at the moment.
Yeah, no, that's totally get it.
I looked those over. I didn't see any changes that I had.
Mr. Chair, I think I have a clarification. Item G is in George. Mr. Steron provided a summary stating that the American Society of Home Inspectors is revising its standards of practice. Not exactly true. The correct wording is that I provided a summary stating that the Arizona chapter of ASHI, along with the BTR, are revising the standards. That's clearly what's happening, and just to be clear on that. So, the Arizona chapter of ASHI and the BTR are revising the standards of practice. We're working in consort with each other here.
Very good. I'll make those changes.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other changes, Bonnie?
Mr. Chairman, I motion to accept the meeting minutes from September 14th.
Do you have a second?
No, Mr. Chairman, I have to abstain. I had to read that meeting.
For minutes, you can still vote.
Then
it's okay.
I second that motion.
Nice. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the meeting minutes with the one change, the meeting minutes from September 14th. Say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, those are accepted. Moving on to the agenda items that begin with the number 5. A is this committee member terms, and just going through those, the terms of the members themselves. Did this start from staff, perhaps, just to clarify everything?
Yeah, I needed clarification just on when those were expiring and had they expired, if they have expired, if we need to go to the board to have them extended.
Well, I already have been to the board. My term that expired in January 2020 was reinstated.
Okay, and I have it up. I found that minutes, as you had said, and it does say that you were.
How many years?
So it should be, it's the
staggered 3 years.
It's staggered 3 years. So if you were going to expire right there and then, you would be 3 years from January 1st, 2021, I would imagine. Let's bring up the packet
actually,
here.
Actually,
yes.
Normally it goes from when, so if Peter was expiring on January or in January of 2020, and the board renewed that, it would be to fulfill that 3 year term that would have started January 2020.
Correct.
Is that what you just said?
No, he said 21.
So right, like okay. So, so you would, so if you just went back in 21.
So you're talking about 23 then.
Yeah.
But so if you want to give Peter 20, an extra year, kind of world.
So Peter, you,
so
your
Peter,
term expires when?
January of
2023.
Isn't that great? Okay.
And then my memory was that I was reinstated perhaps 2 to 3 months before that, but it could have been that it was after, you know, my term had.
That's how I think it, because of how I have this Mel County term. Yours expires basically next January. So you would probably need to be reinstated for the 3 years after that. We don't really keep up on this, and I think we've done this many times where you guys are extended like halfway through your terms or right at the end. And so I'm trying to keep up on it a bit more. That's why this is coming around.
Right.
And I think, Paul, you had expired last year, so I think both of you will need to have the board vote to extend your...
So...
Or renew.
Do we, what do we do when there's an appointment that's expired? Do you typically send out notification to all of the registered home inspectors to
they
see
did
if
for
there's
me, I remember.
Interest?
Mm-hmm. And there were.
You know, I think in most times that's the case, unless for whatever reason there was just a administrative extension for whatever reason, but. But it that is often the case, and sometimes because we've been a little bit behind, just get it before the board, get it done, and then next time we'll put it out to the public. Sometimes that's probably happened.
So since, should we do that in January then, put out a notification saying that we have an expired appointment?
It'll technically be two of them come January, because...
Probably should put it out.
When
you're
apart.
No.
But
wait a minute. Yeah,
it's already
yeah.
passed.
Oh,
so
already
what
passed.
Is the board's best communication method these days? Is there an e-newsletter anymore gonna, like, what do you got? What would you do as a method of getting the word out?
At this time, we haven't really done a newsletter in quite some time just because of COVID and everything else that's
right.
been going on here. It's just been the back burner.
Right.
But a mass email can be done. I've done that, and that's pretty easy.
Okay.
Just creating a template and sending it out to the population.
Okay.
When you do that, could you please make sure that they know that this is not just a come in, sit down, run around, and leave situation? They need to be able to do the work. There's a lot of work involved. Okay, so
how about Kurt and I draft something and we'll yeah. share it with you, and you can
thank you. Find something that makes
let us
that clear.
Feel like it's right.
Because we had half a dozen guys come into wanting my position the last time we went to the board, mm-hmm. and we haven't heard a peep out of any of them since, not even on the EAC committees. Okay, so we really need to let them know that this is not just something for the resume.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a working position.
And we have historically asked for a letter of interest to explain their qualifications, their areas of service historically, and
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things. So,
along with their CV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's what we've done in the past.
But I did reach out to all those that were interested in Peter's position to try and get them involved and be a part of the standards revision and just... There are a lot of folks who love to have it on their resume and market it, but you know, that's not what this job is really for here.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely true. Need them to be fully engaged.
And then going further with that, would it be best if the existing members kind of threw it in their Google Calendar, or do you now have a Google Calendar to that would cause you to spot it months ahead of time or whatever we want to set down as a standard going forward?
Yeah. It looks like every single year on the year on an anniversary, it looks like someone's going to expire. And I think it's just like your end of the year looking at the checklist. There should also be
that's
something like that.
Standard thing in October maybe or something.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how I see it.
It sounds good.
I agree.
That'd be something to write in the policy. Okay.
Okay. Let us know if you need any help from us on that.
Okay.
How we're going forward. Great. Okay, that is 5A. Any other discussion on that?
Again, that's two positions. right? We're going to say that are open, the chair and mine.
And one's from a small county, so right. 400,000 or less.
I think I actually still have the language from your position a couple of years ago, and we did the send out as well.
It specifically says 400,000 or less.
We did that because that was actually from statute at day one, because we wanted representation from small counties, because they have different things that they face.
So does that just eliminate Pima, Maricopa, and...
Pima, Maricopa, and that's
it?
All. And Coconino was...
Getting close.
It was getting closer, and someday we'll have to go to the legislature if we want to keep Flagstaff in there. Pinal's probably going crazy, too, but, from Google searches, I think we'll still be okay for anywhere but the Tucson, Pima and Maricopa.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, all right. Very good. Thank you for that. Let's see. There's a staff question that has arisen, and it's item 5B. It's, can a guest house, casita, or grandmother flat be considered a separate dwelling unit and be listed separately from the main dwelling on a parallel inspection log to fulfill the requirements of R430 247, item 6?
I'm going to say this is my favorite item on the agenda for today, because as Julie continues to bring new, fun, adventurous things for us to explore, her team, this was kind of red flagged because they're looking and they see the same address right there. And so, boy, we've had lengthy discussions and are looking forward to what you and the experts in the field will weigh in on that.
I'll start. I have an opinion. This is Dave Swartz for those on the call. But I would say it should not be allowed. It would be freakishly rare that it would have a parking facility, a garage, or even a carport. It would probably lack a main service entrance section for electrical. It would lack a true main water supply and a true main sewer connection. They're joined between houses typically, and it's simply a subsection of the house in every way. So
right.
I would say no, it should not be allowed.
I almost fully agree. I have seen guest houses with their own meter, both water and electrical. All right? And casitas, I believe, are totally out of the picture. Right? But what are we calling this, a grandmother flat?
Well, we just,
Okay.
I mean, you could have the same structure and have five people call it five different things.
Well, that too should go.
Definitions of those.
I think that if it's a freestanding unit with its own gas meter, its own water meter, and some do, okay, and is not, and has its own, well, maybe not a garage, but a carport, we can have either or, then there could be a case made that this is an actual dwelling hall standard.
There could be. However, that's a lot of subjective material that you're talking about that we do not have anything clearly defined for.
We don't need to do the research. We just need to get it out there to tell these gentlemen and ladies that the house, if they're going to put in with the same address as a B or an A, that they need to prove to us that this is a freestanding, totally independent unit. Maybe then put the onus on them.
Then we'd have to draft a lengthy set of requirements and could not be connected by roof or by wall. It's
messy. Common sense.
It should be a minimum square footage, right? And it must have a kitchen, and it must, it's just so messy. Let's just...
That's what I'm worried about on the back end for staff. It's
staff
already a nightmare. And, I mean, these are parallels that we're talking about, mm-hmm. right? So... Is it the greatest benefit for this?
I think
it's the same property. It can be sold independently.
It cannot be sold independently. That's a very good point.
Where can it not? Well, that would be the criteria then, wouldn't it? Where is the gentleman who complained about this?
She's right there.
I saw a letter from somebody.
It was from an applicant, but staff caught it on their parallel log and questioned it.
It was, who's that guy who runs the school? I said his name just the other
Smith.
Day. I'm getting old. Yeah, Smith. Keith.
Keith.
Keith Smith. Didn't Keith Smith have some...
He intended to be involved in this meeting for this reason, but...
He's not here. Keith Smith, are you here? No?
Mr. Smith, are you on the line?
It's catastrophically messy. It would have to be a certain square footage. It would have to have this whole range
of
criteria we could never prove or identify.
One thing also, that might... Oh, this is Aaron Green.
This is Mr. Dion. He's going to talk on the standards, but I don't. It's a public meeting, so I don't think it...
Oh.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Dion.
Yes, all right. Thank you for letting me throw in 2 cents on this. I also provide parallel inspections. I think that as long as it has a different MLS, I know that with the new changes probably a year or 2 years ago, it said that it doesn't technically need to be part of a sale to be counted as a parallel, from my understanding. However, a different address or at least an MLS, I mean, most of the time parallels are done based off of actual inspections that are being done. So I would recommend that if it has a different MLS, then yeah, great. If it has the same MLS, it's one address. I don't know. That's my 2 cents.
That makes sense. I mean, an MLS means a separate property.
It'll be a separate number when you go search on any Zillow or, you know, realtor.com.
But I've never seen, Mr. Dion, have you ever seen an MLS on a guest house, for instance?
No.
They don't have.
If there's a, I've done two, two duplexes next to each other, and both of them had different MLSs. That wasn't 4 inspections for the parallel guy, that was 2. Because they had different MLSs, even though it was the same buyer, there's 2 here and there's 2 here, but that's only 2 inspections because they're 2 duplexes, that's 2 MLSs. It's not 4 inspections, it's not 1, it's just 2.
That's good input. Thank you. Mr. Green, could we?
Yes. My concern is that since we're just interpreting the regulation and trying to determine what it encompasses, there's a canon of construction called the presumption of the non-exclusive include. And towards the bottom of 430.101.8, that defines detached single-family dwelling, it says the term detached single-family dwelling also includes all subsidiary building structures and improvements. Since, you know, our authority is prescribed by, you know, regulation and statute, I think our primary duty here has to be determining what the regulation tells us a detached family dwelling is. If we're looking at things like
if it has its own
MLS or if it could be sold separately, I think those might be appropriate subjects of rulemaking. And there might be practical reasons that we make those clarifications. But interpreting the statute as it's written, it seems to be fairly comprehensive. And I would think that we really can't consider any of these subsidiary buildings as a separate dwelling when the regulation presently says a single-family dwelling includes all of those other structures without any carve-outs or exclusions. And so a rule change might be appropriate, but as far as giving guidance to staff at this point, I would say we can't consider any of these as being appropriate to be listed separately.
Exceptional insight. Thank you.
Kind of my own ignorance. So the MLS part, would that change your outlook on that when it's the property's divided in differently?
Well,
if the property was divided, it would have a separate address. I don't think we'd even be having this conversation.
True.
I mean, well, even the definition guest house, casita, grandma flat, that implies some sort of subsidiarity to a main building.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by definition, it's in relation to another house that is considered the main single-family dwelling.
Okay.
So I think, unless we're willing to make a rule change, I think it's pretty comprehensive the way it's written.
Do you have a question, Julie?
I could see the argument coming back of someone maybe renting out the guest house to someone and those occupants wanting a home inspection separately just for their guest house.
But that's not a parallel provision that we're really considering.
That would be done by the home inspector writing two reports. It's as simple as that. And two different people paying him if that's what it takes, you know. But
but could we count that second?
To count it as a parallel, it seems to be going to the no side of that.
Right.
Now, do we need to take action on that? Because we actually have cases where they have tried this. Mr. Chairman?
Well, when we suggested that we would take that to the board because that wasn't clear and we weren't comfortable, mm-hmm. then they just said, forget it, and submitted
another parallel.
But I was informed mm-hmm. by Mr. Smith that this had been happening. You know, they had done this in the past, inspections on guest houses or something.
Is it just
and
that
it came, they got through. So we should research and find out which ones it were.
So we've just been taking a closer look at everything.
That makes sense.
Everything.
Well, since
not
he
just
runs
home inspector,
a school,
I mean everything at the agency. So.
Since he runs a school, is it appropriate for staff to reach out to him and make mention of the fact that it is, you know, a subsidiary building to the main house and it would not qualify, according to statute?
Yeah, if he's questioning still.
So he doesn't continue.
Mr. Green, is that according to statute or according to rules?
According to rule. That's out of my interpretation.
Oh, that's
a rule. R430-101. So we could change it, but... So I'm looking specifically at the last sentence of 101-8.
And that's just defining detached single-family dwelling.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just as a reminder, a rule change, you're looking at
2 years.
A lot of work and way down the road, if we could open a package, if we'd be allowed to do it. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a huge issue. It's not worth that. If there's other things to change and you wanted to put in a definition or something, but I think
we got our clarification.
Yeah.
That's fairly clear here. All right, then.
I'm satisfied.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Any other discussion?
Anything else?
All right. No action required on that.
No action required?
Let's move to agenda item 5C, the parallel inspector affidavit revision.
This is causing a lot of trouble.
And so one thing to consider is when we began parallels, the computer systems down here were catastrophically limited. So there was zero interest in creating a second tier of a supervising inspector that could perform parallels for applicants. And so there was never any chance of us moving forward with that concept. Now perhaps the computers are different and perhaps that could happen where certain people have proven one time that they've met the qualifications and, you know, I'd have to cross-check against any kind of complaints or things that have occurred in their historic relationship with the board. But the other option is that we could create the document, in my mind, that we could create the document that is the sign-off sheet to include the affidavit, or have them do it once. So option three, have them put the affidavit in, not an affidavit, the attestation in one time, register it with the board. Board just needs to check two things. Have they received discipline, and do they have one on file?
Mr. Chairman, maybe you should outline the problems that this is causing.
We've been doing parallels since the very beginning because we knew they were going to have to be required to get a license. So we've been doing it 18 years or however long it's been that we've been licensing folks. And I sent the folks that are willing to do parallels to get one at first signed, and they just wouldn't do it because it had, you know, a listing of another name. So some of the people doing notary services were, it's just a very inconsistent process whether they'll put their notary seal on it or not. Now the form's cleaned up, but it's every single time, and it's just, it's such a headache to a system that is fragile anyway. There, we want people to be willing to do the parallels, and when you put up roadblocks, it just further worsens our condition to for people to get their parallels completed. And it just shouldn't be that way. We can come up with a method here.
So this one might need a rule change then, because this went to our legal counsel and two of his bosses, and they said this requires a notary, and it can't be one on file the way it's worded. That's where that came from.
Right.
So the language hasn't changed. Why that wasn't ever put into play, I don't know, but you can, if you want to vent your anger, do it towards me, because that's another thing that I questioned when I got here and sent it to my legal counsel for clarification. So this came from the Attorney General's office, that this is the way it needs to go, that the language hasn't changed, it isn't new, it should have been done that way from the beginning.
I think it's a lack of knowledge of that an affidavit requires a notary seal. That didn't exist as a, you know, or we'd have not worded it that way from the beginning, I believe. But since it does, I think we need to come up with an interim solution. And it's not really an anger. It's just like, let's fix it. Let's find a way to fix it. I guess in any respect, staff has to check whether there's been discipline against these folks every time, right? So in my mind, for now, a solution could be that the parallel inspector walks into a notary and I want 10 of these or 20 of these signed, and they hand it to the guy or gal getting parallels at completion. That's one solution.
Say that again? Or go ahead, Julie.
So the parallel inspector only needs to do one affidavit for the applicant, even if they're doing 10 parallel inspections with that
right.
same applicant.
Right. So why can't we even have a final solution where they file the one with the board, get it notarized, file it with the board, you have it scanned on file, you just check discipline, and is that person approved?
Because you're attesting to the specific parallels that are coming in at that time.
So if
you can
they've
have
done,
like a blanket.
If they've done 250, that number doesn't go down. They're attesting that they've done 250 inspections, that they've been at it for 3 years. Those numbers are not going down, they're only rising. The only other thing they're attesting to is that they have no discipline at the board within the last 3 years. That's it. And board can check that.
Is there a notary in the building?
Yep. In our agency.
You have to be face-to-face.
Well, that's another idea. The gentlemen or ladies that are doing parallels, could they come here and get notarized so they don't have any problems with this applicant's name on it? Okay?
You mean one time?
You mean you'd want it notarized without the form being completed?
Well, no, you can put the applicant's name on it, but the problem
the applicant's
is
name came
still,
off, didn't
it's
it?
It's still there, but it's not below the black line. But
wait,
you
we have a proposed. Turn that over.
This one says current.
That's the current form.
Oh,
that
I'm reading the wrong one. Okay.
So the proposed change eliminates the applicant's name.
Well, if the applicant's name isn't on here, I don't see why we can't file a signed form.
Right. So if we change this form to the proposed change, then...
Mr. Green, do you feel this proposed change meets the rules?
Well, let's ask our legal counsel,
yeah.
Deanie, who's on the line, because Although Aaron is an attorney, he is our public member and not our legal counsel.
I'm not going to be providing legal
advice at this point. I'm just giving back.
Are you a lawyer?
I am.
Oh, okay.
Fairly newly minted, too, so again. Been practicing for about a year. So
cool.
So I'm sorry, I was muted. The only thing you're proposing to do is to remove the applicant's name from the affidavit. Is that the deal?
We revised the notary section because it was not formatted properly. And we experienced notaries.
Correct. Okay, I see that.
Yeah.
But you're also removing the applicant's name?
Yes. Yes.
In looking at these two rules, I don't see where it's required that the affidavit contain the applicant's name.
Yeah. I think it just has to be given to the applicant as part of their...
So Danny, would it be all right to sign one of these and have it on file with the board, with staff?
So, Scott...
And you said you got legal advice about this before, and they said you had to have one every time? Is that what they said?
Yeah, they...
I don't know who that was.
Yes, Scott said we couldn't have one just on file with the board.
I'm certainly not going to overrule Scott. I'm sure he has a reason for saying that.
It says it must be in the packet. Is there anything that would prevent staff from inserting a copy of it in the packet and being part of the process to complete the packet? By way of just at the time of review, you verify they have no disciplinary actions in the last 3 years, and you throw that document in the packet at that time, just to like actually get things moving here.
Is it just that last sentence of AACR 430-1022, the applicant shall provide a signed affidavit from the parallel inspector?
I was thinking staff.
Is that the crux?
That is such a hard reading of this, the logic of operating a system to do this.
It really is hard reading.
That is just catastrophically hard reading.
Well, what I would suggest is, because this, you've already received some advice from Scott, to take it up with him again, ask him to reconsider, because I'm not in a position to overrule him at this point. Mm-hmm. I can see where he might interpret this to mean that each applicant has to provide a signed affidavit from a parallel inspector. So
that's easy.
Instead of, otherwise it would say the applicant shall provide reference to a parallel inspector who's already been approved. it doesn't say that. So
I have a thought about, I guess I'd like clarification from the other board members. Is the confusion stemming from the proximity of the, in the current form, the applicant's name to the parallel inspector's name, and we're just confusing notaries, or is it just too much of a hassle to get each of these?
Yeah, notaries are unwilling to sign with the applicant present.
So my suggestion would be, with the applicant present. Well, we are getting the parallel inspector to sign this.
Right.
So I could see why they would need a notary there. But my suggestion would be, if we need the applicant to submit these, I would say just move that line somewhere else on the form so that it's clear that, and perhaps even add a note to the notary, this is the person who is required to provide this form, and have a line for their name, and then keep everything else down here with the parallel inspector and have them sign and notarize that.
I would concur with that. I think you could, up above I attest, before that paragraph, you could put regarding applicant and then the name.
Yeah,
that would make sense. And then it's not like it's in the signature block.
It does not specifically require that the document have the name of the applicant on it. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct.
I don't see that it does, but if you feel like you need that for administrative reasons, I think if you put it in a different spot, you might overcome
it
the objection.
Yeah. Well, notary. It says the applicant shall provide it. I guess how else are you going to tell how else are you going to maintain a record of who provided the affidavit?
They're already signing other documents in the packet. The supervising inspector is signing every house, mm-hmm. a line at every house that mm-hmm. I did this.
Right.
So it's just a roadblock, and the more you create, the more difficult the process gets, and people bow out of it, and you're. We're just going to be in trouble. I can predict it right now. We're already in trouble.
Right. Yeah, sure. Parallel inspectors don't want to do parallels.
The spirit of this is that we want them to say that I have qualified for this. I have done 250 without inspections, without having to prove it to you guys, right? I have done this, and I do not have any disciplinary action, and I've been in business for 3 years. Besides the disciplinary action, those numbers only increase, right? So our fear factor is out of line here. With
I don't have any fear factor on
so,
this.
That's just a reading of rules.
It's just, trying to do things according to the Arizona
but
Administrative
when
Code.
Every word like that,
I'm not disagreeing with you that they're obviously
well,
not shrinking
the difficulty
in there.
Is,
you know.
I mean, the alternative is someone challenges the process and then it has to be defended before court. And if we move outside the boundaries that are prescribed for us by our own regulations or by statute, then we're going to lose.
But I don't see how we're moving out of the boundaries.
Well, if the regulation says the applicant must provide the affidavit, mm-hmm. then we've moved outside of it.
It does not say that the applicant's name
they
has to be on the affidavit.
But he has to provide it, though. That's what it
he
says.
He has to provide
well, so
the
it comes
affidavit.
With, but it comes with his package. He right. provides his parallels.
Okay.
He provides his application.
Just to clarify, we're not arguing about the applicant being on this anymore, because I took it out on the proposed. It's nowhere on there. We don't want it there. Nobody here wants
Nobody
it there.
Wants it, yeah.
But
okay.
we're saying is
I
that s- when
I
we're
can see a solution now, but with our rules package change for the standards of practice, I want to work towards getting this changed to just a simple attestation.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous.
We agree.
Okay. What you would call it.
And
gentlemen, what you would call it.
An attestation.
A declaration.
A declaration.
Declaration, sure.
You call it a declaration. It's not an attestation. It's a declaration.
Okay, let's like put that in minutes, please, that mm-hmm. that will work towards that to be included in the standards of practice revision rule change.
With the word declaration.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually 1 year. If we never get started...
No.
I've done this a long time.
The sooner we can submit it.
Yeah. I've been down here a long time.
Just so you know, there are specific language requirements for declarations that you have to include by statute. But you can figure that out later. I mean, it's not that complicated. You just have to look it up and put the specific language in the declaration that needs to be there, and then you don't need a notary.
Okay, I have a good question then. Is this easier if we just made the board keep a list and if somebody wants to provide parallels, they have to apply to you one time and they provide the, I don't care what document, you can get it notarized by 9 people and they get that on file and then they're in, except, and then there's a cross-check system. Your system will link over and put a mark on theirs if they get a disciplinary action against them.
Meaning a one-time declaration for each
they
parallel.
Are a separate, they're already separate in here. They're a parallel inspector. You have a classification called that at this agency, and they apply to that once with an affidavit.
But we don't have a separate classification, registration, designation for a parallel inspector.
It's defined there. Can
well,
we, is that an easier rule change for staff? Is it better? A better change?
There is no easy rule change for any of us.
Once completed, is
but,
it better for staff?
You
it's
mean
better
how it
for
reads.
Us.
2 years ago.
Because we talked about having a separate designation for parallel.
We do. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, there was no such thing as a parallel inspector definition. Right now, through rule change, we have defined the parallel inspector and the parallel inspection through rule change, which makes the parallel inspector a different class of inspector. Okay? Because
yes
a person,
and no, because
it does.
You're
because
still
a person,
a home inspector.
A person, it's not
you're
noted,
registered as a home inspector.
It's not noted as a different class, but a person who has only been in the business for a year cannot do this job.
Right.
You
know
what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
A person who's been in business for 3 years with 250 inspections and clear with the board can do this job, and so in essence, there's two layers of inspectors.
So why didn't they pursue having that as a separate registration?
That wasn't thought through that much 20 years ago.
And there were the computers could not even handle, they just didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There was no
back in Mr.
interest.
Dalrymple's time.
We are so far
we're
from
we're talking that. About way back.
That's why we want to move this forward.
We couldn't do anything like this, all right?
We're getting ready to go to a completely online transition that would allow for any...
In Mrs. Cornelius's time, we were able to define parallel inspector, and I actually defended this in front of GIRC. So I know that this is a rule that is good. Okay? In essence, it is a different layer of an inspector. It's somebody
can
with
I,
experience.
Yep, go ahead.
Can I make a comment here, John?
Yes.
Ladies? In order to create a separate registration for parallel inspector, which is what I think you're talking about doing, you have to make sure that you have statutory authority to do that independently of the rule. So I don't know without looking at the statutes whether you do or do not,
mm-hmm.
but
do not.
That's something you're going to have to, that has to be established first, and then if you do have that authority, you can create a registration for parallel inspector, but
Deanie,
you have to have statutory authority.
Deanie, I don't think anybody wants to do that. I don't think we're pushing towards making a two-tier inspector. Nobody wants to go back to statute on this. But we have it in rules that it takes a certain qualification for someone to be a parallel inspector. And the only way we control that is simply by them signing a form that says they're qualified right now.
Does make sense to go more towards a one-time verification.
Sure.
That seems like where we should be going on this, you know, moving towards that, this is going to be a future agenda item for sure. We've got a some kind of stopgap measure to get through this now, but I don't think we need any additional separate registration, licensing, anything for parallel. I think there's hopefully there's a way. We can simply pursue the one-time thing, and maybe that'll help. The challenge is that if we make it too difficult for the schools, it's just going to blow up on us, right in our face, and then we're going to be scrambling because we're going to be inhibiting entry into the profession. And that's the worst thing that we want to be accused of, right? So it is touchy, and as David was saying, the more hurdles we put in, the tougher it's going to be for the school.
I don't think anybody wants to put hurdles in. It's public protection,
right.
And
but
following
now
the law
in,
that's in
now,
place. But and
right. Yeah, but now fully enforcing the
as to
notarized
enforcing.
Affidavit, but fully enforcing it, frankly, which we hadn't always done in the past, is now increasing the burden on the inspection community. So that
it's a barrier to entry to the profession.
Then
it just flat
then
is.
Just
it is right
to be
now.
Fixed. But you can't identify something, get legal counsel from the Attorney General's office saying this is the way it has to be. It should have always been this way, and then say, oh well, let's just pretend we didn't.
But the
do
like
that.
Business wants to create solutions. So we're business. We're trying to come with solutions. We run into the hardline reading of statute. We can deal with it. I promise. I have an idea. But I've got to get this improved because you don't want to be accused of barriers of entry, right?
That's absolutely not what no.
So let's look at this. What would happen if we just simply change the rules to take out applicant must provide? Then it would shift the burden to you, and staff could just come up with what you think is best for you. Because we don't want to, we have our ideas, but we don't know what's a burden to you. We don't know what's hard for you to keep track of. We just want it easy for us. And we have a lot of brains in the room. Why can't we get this done? I'm just desperately wanting this done as fast as possible.
I would say the first thing is, do you guys like the proposed change in that form for now?
I do.
Okay.
There's Thank one you. Typo I've identified.
Oh.
As in the I attest paragraph.
Oh, yeah, I see it. I think it's when you justify the margins sometimes.
Yeah, that sometimes.
Stuff and then switch it to PDF and back. I bet if you put it back in Word, that would go away.
Okay, I'll look.
My humble suggestion would be to try to maintain strict compliance with the rule, is to have somewhere on here just a place for the applicant to put their name. I, at least my reading of the rule.
Can you tell me where it says the applicant's name must be on the form?
I don't believe it says the applicant's name must be on the form, but when I take your earlier point about everything else in the packet having the applicant's name, but I think it would be helpful when we're, well, not helpful, that's not the right word. When you're talking about submitting an additional document along with that packet, I think it's important to demonstrate on review that it is in fact the applicant that's providing it, and not just maybe I am overthinking this.
You're certainly throwing up another roadblock.
I understand that. I'm also, trying to make sure we're not running afoul of either our legal counsel or the rule as it's currently stated.
The one thing that's sure is we fully discussed it, and perhaps if we could get Scott to listen to this section of the recording and then let him return some thoughts to us or ideas and solutions and all that.
Perhaps it would be better to come to Scott with specific proposals and have him weigh on the legality of that, because I know he's not going to feel comfortable proposing policy solutions.
No, anyway.
That's our job.
Right.
And I feel like I had Scott looked at this proposed change. I can clarify that.
He did.
And what was the result?
He had no issues.
So he has no issues with it. Then I'm, whatever objection I have, I'll withdraw it if he thinks it complies with the rule. But if we're going to go farther than this, I would suggest going to him with specific proposals that we come up with, because legal counsel's not just going to.
Well, we're just going to move forward with the rules change is what we're going to do.
Okay.
And then he'll be a part of that throughout. Mm-hmm. So that'll work.
So
for clarification, Mr. Chairman, we're going to stick with this proposed change.
Yes.
And every application will have every parallel inspector that's listed in an application will have a notary.
We'll submit this form notarized.
Notarized.
By the.
And then we're going to move ahead with the proposed change to eliminate the note.
And you guys want me to talk to Scott about that specific last sentence and if it can be interpreted with some sort of somebody turning in one affidavit?
Yes. I think we already talked about that.
Okay.
Can you foresee as staff, like, a burden either way, like, to that they could get it done once? We could find a way to get it done once.
If it was in rule that said you attest once that you've met these, because then you're just checking on discipline anyway.
Which we do anyway.
Which you would do anyway.
I imagine it would be on file, like the seal affidavit. So somewhere it would indicate that we have one on file, and then we could just check.
It would just be a document under the CRM.
Right.
So I can create a box that just says parallel inspector and check the box.
So for purposes of clarifying our thoughts, just based on the discussion, would it make sense to have the proposed rule change to simply strike the provided by the applicant? That way the parallel inspector could provide it, or you guys could come up with whatever method works the very best, most efficient for you. But if we could strike that section of wording, it would solve a lot of problems.
Mm. And when you guys do your standards and you put that in,
right,
it could probably hopefully go in this whole same package.
Yes, that's what we hope for.
Yeah.
I did have a question about this proposed form. Would it cause the roadblock, the same roadblock for the notary, if we had the applicant's name like at the very top, as we do in some other forms in our applications? Just so that, because we work with so much paper, it might be misplaced, and we would not know which applicant this affidavit goes to.
I don't see how that would cause a problem if it was at the very top of the. To be included with John Smith's whatever, and his application number.
Don't you cross-reference the supervising inspector or parallel inspector with that packet anyway? So if you have one, it's either going to match or it's not. It's some other person, or it's the person that signed his name 30 times.
On the other hand, if it was written in a different font and was explained, like you said, what you just said, okay, this is part of the application or whatever. As a devil's advocate, do you think that would slow down, would put a brake on the notary from signing the form if it was up in a different font, almost as a title to the form?
It would have to say, notary, notice to notary, disregard this section or something. So because they see names on here, and they think both people have to be in front of me, or I'm not putting a seal. Right.
But if it says in small font, part of application for, and they put the guy's name in there, the notary is...
That's what I'm thinking is, something like that indicates this is...
Because I can understand. You've seen our packages, right? And when they get spread over a desk... Papers get dropped on the floor, they get scraped up. Oh, yeah, this is the application, the parallel affidavit.
Then the form that they're searching for is the guy, is Peter Leeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
You either have Peter Leeds' form in there or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Leeds has attested, has confirmed that he qualifies.
But it's not that
he signed his name 30 times.
Yeah, but he didn't. He signed his name, he didn't write his name. And I see these applications all the time. When you get the parallel inspection...
He's signing his name here.
When you get the parallel inspection, you can check signatures. But when you get the parallel inspector's log, his name is not on it. Only his signature.
I'm just telling you, the more roadblocks... It's going to get really ugly.
Well, then I got a better
idea. People are going to
make it a double-sided form and put the home inspector's name on the back.
I'm trying to understand the concern.
Which is fine. Applicant could write their name on there after it's been notarized, but there has to be a way for us to indicate that we need that on there. The only thing. That's why
I
wanted...
You can lose these papers easy. I mean, I lose them on my own desk when I'm doing assessments.
So say the packet has nothing in it, your application's incomplete.
I don't want to open...
Just do it. I'm kind of done.
I'm not done. I don't want to...
Here's one more point, too, because Julie, say what you just said. Julie's...
Which part?
I was asking
that
you
that it
if,
could come in even potentially separately.
If they hadn't included it in their initial application package, they might send it in afterwards. And, the girls are processing multiple applications at once, potentially having the same parallel inspector. So,
Go for it. Just make it clear to the notary that they do not have to have this human in front of them.
Wouldn't it make you feel better if I revise it and then I share it with you guys, get your opinions, and then I'll be CC. I don't want it to make it a quorum or anything like that, but get your opinions on it before I send it out.
Oh, yeah, gosh. We're not going to... Yeah, no.
I don't need to see it again. I do want to know that when we're opening up highways to make it easier for our parallels, we're not at the same time throwing blocks and roadblocks in front of staff. We've got to be able to be doing this properly.
That's fine.
Well, thanks for that. And for what it's worth, guys, we are this close to an online transition, and these things are even talking about, not all of them, the paper issues and all that, Everything will be submitted electronically. It will all be online.
So we can shut down until that comes on.
Oh, yeah, no new applications for the next year and a half. We've asked for the appropriated funds in the next fiscal year. I have no reason to believe we wouldn't receive that. We'll move forward quickly. We already have a vendor in place. It's going to change the world for BTR in a very positive, wonderful way.
That's awesome. Well, I just request that you have Scott still review it for, you know, whether he's got this heightened concern over this matter of the person's name on there and how to address it, because he's another brain to get in on the discussion.
Absolutely.
And then move forward with whatever you think, and then let us know when it's out, though.
It will probably be a mass email again.
And we do have a notary on staff here, and we're currently working on another notary. So we'll have two notaries on staff.
Nobody's driving down here. Our guys are too busy to drive here.
I'm just saying, we're trying. We're trying. Mm-hmm. That's one more. We're trying.
No, I appreciate that.
So if the budget gets passed, you can drive out.
No.
That would be interesting.
I don't let him out of the office room. He's too valuable here.
Well, so do we need to make a motion on this?
It sounds like more like a delegate.
We're going
to
continue.
We need a motion because I wouldn't know what to
do. We'll continue looking at the form.
Move to send it back to staff for typo revision.
You can do that.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. I move that we send the affidavit form back to staff for a revision, incorporating a notice to the notary at the top or some place out of the way, and one typo revision.
Do we have a second?
Yeah, I'll second.
Any more discussion? Because it's been fun.
I'm good.
Paul, did you just second that?
Yes, I did.
Paul did.
Okay.
All right, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Nay? No. Okay, motion passes.
Kurt, this is Jeannie.
Yes?
I lost my connection for a little bit, so I'm back on, I think, but
yes.
Apparently it just cut out on me,
that's
so
why we need to
that
keep
might happen
up
again.
There. Okay. Everybody's got the packet to look at. So.
Okay, so now we're on to Agenda Item 5D, which is the Home Inspector Standards of Practice, Professional Practice Revision, which I have sorted through, and you guys did an amazing job.
You can thank Paul for that. He did 9/10 of the work.
You both killed it.
So. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I don't know how far you want to dig down into these. I had done a cursory review at the September meeting, and obviously now we have an early draft of these standards that I have started to put together.
I'd like to go through each one.
Okay. And
not that many.
Yeah, there aren't that many. And I've been working with Roger Skaggs, the president of the Arizona chapter of the American Society of Home Inspectors. Who is present here. Thank you, Roger, for being here. And so let's go ahead and go through these. I do have on the ones that are, I don't want to say contentious, but let's just say that we haven't made a final decision on some of these yet. I have put duplicate commentary in here as far as showing what it might look with a couple different options. And I think, let's go ahead and go through this. And I'm gonna start breezing through it, and I'm going to ask for anyone to stop me or slow me down as I'm doing this. On the first page, Peter, I don't know, that might have been left over.
I just
it might have been
down.
Your comment, let's not lose the statement, but that's not an edit, that's just a comment.
Right.
Just
mm-hmm.
to be clear, nothing striking
mm-hmm.
out
mm-hmm.
there.
I did want to note one typo. There appears to be a second 2.2 right above number 3.
2.2 right above number
right above general limitations and exclusions.
Should be 2.4.
Well, is that a 2.4?
Oh, it's a 80, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, that 2.2 comes out.
Yeah, that's a typo because the standards have got that right. That 2.2 should just disappear.
Yeah.
Do we have a copy of the standards? Can we put them up as they are written?
That's a good idea.
There you go.
Where do you want to be?
2.2, 2.3. So you want to move to 2.3? Yeah, it should be. Okay, good. That's good.
So 2.3. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that should just be A and B.
Mm-hmm. So there's no change now.
Okay. So one initial change was, let me get this in order here. I forgot we're working on two sides of the page, general limitation. So the first change was with three,
3.212. You're
looking at 3B12. 3-2-B12. 3-2-B12, thank you. Operate automatic safety controls. Operate automatic safety controls. So this was under inspectors not required to do. And
can you slide to that section on the standards? All the way down to 2.2. So we have 10 and 11.
3.2?
3.2B and towards the end.
I apologize. Yeah, 3.2.
Yeah, so that's 3. Just 2. An addition.
So we, yeah, but it's, okay, there it is. All right, thank you.
Stay yeah, there. And this this came in regarding, Peter, I believe this was the garage door safety reversing piece on
or
why
it,
we...
It could be heating system automatic safety controls. You don't have...
Right,
have
it wasn't specific,
their,
right.
Verify their presence, you don't have to operate them, is what we're
right,
saying. Right,
right.
Yeah, but that's probably already in the heating section.
It says you must observe. Means to...
All right, on the heating 9.3, it says 9.3B, the inspector is not required to operate automatic safety controls, so it's not a heating issue. In the plumbing on the water heaters, it might be there already, too. If we go to plumbing, that would be what?
7.
7, thank you. 7.3, the inspector
yep,
is
right.
Not required to operate automatic safety
right.
controls.
I'm
so
I'm still not
100% sure. To put it in 3.3 would be not only redundant, but it would also, it also brings me to the one thing about this change I don't like. If it was put in for automatic safety controls on overhead doors, I'm not on board with not testing overhead.
Let's get to that. Let's just defer 12. I'm not 100% sure that, frankly, 12 is needed.
It's in the wrong place if it's about garage doors, right?
Yeah,
personally,
it might
I would
be.
Strike it.
Frankly, I think it. It did, it might have gotten put in the wrong place. I got to the point where I had looked at this document so many times
sure.
I couldn't look at it anymore, and I realized that there was things that needed to be cleaned up, and that's probably one of them. So let's just go to exterior item 5. Yes, Kurt.
I apologize. Did you want to jump on the 2.2 from Mr. Dion's email, since it's kind of closer to the top of the whole thing?
2.2. All right, what's he saying?
Let's we go to... his email. I would like to discuss the verbiage and possible rewording of section 2.2A3, the name and address, certificate number of this inspector.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. So
what's the motivation of that? Do we know what?
Mr. Dion, I see that you're still on the line.
Yes.
Okay.
Could you give us your background, Mr. Dion, on your concern, your interest in making that change?
My interest is that I'm a home inspector with employees, and my employees, they're not independent guys. They work for a company. So As far as putting on an inspection agreement, their home address instead of the company's home address, that's the short end of it.
Is there something that indicates it would need to be there?
On the other hand, Mr. Dion, we actually certify home inspectors, not home inspector companies. So when a certification for a home inspector is doing a home inspection and is certified, we do want his home address on there.
Or not a home address. But
his business address.
That's public record, right? So if there is a concern, then they can easily see the home inspector that did the inspection. If it needs to be raised for question whatsoever, that's public record. It's in there. I think at least my company has a firm number with the state. So the home inspection company and the firm have been, you know, submitted to the state. So,
but on the agreement, who's the client's working with whom? Your company? And
correct.
Your company name and your company address should be on that document then.
Correct.
So then I can see the confusion would be A3, as it's currently worded, says the name, address, and certification number of the inspector.
Not the company.
Not the company.
It seems like the certification number of the inspector seems completely logical, not
right.
The firm certification number.
It's the address.
But
it's got to be on there. And my opinion on that is simply that when there's a complaint against this home inspector, we're not going after the firm. We call the home inspector in here. Okay?
Right. When you look at the inspection report, the report states all that stuff. So the report would state the inspector that did it.
Mm-hmm.
The agreement is with the company. The agreement is not with the inspector. The agreement is with my inspection company, my insurance. I'm the one who's going to have to go to court. Yeah, he's going to get called in too, but for the inspection agreement itself, my company he's an employee. He's not a 1099. He's going to be covered by me. I'm the guy who's going to get the call at the end of the day by lawyers who's going to have to defend my employee. So if there is an issue that is brought to the board for an inspection report, that report will include the inspector who did the inspection and their license number.
Am I missing something? I don't know that there's anything that would prevent the business address from...
Yeah, put the business address on the...
It doesn't say it has to be a home address or personal address. It just says name, address, and certification. So the name is unique to the inspector, the certification to the inspector, the address. I mean, Deanie, am I missing something? Couldn't that be the business address that the individual works for?
Do we?
I don't think it specifies.
But it's not the inspector.
I agree. It could be the business address.
Because, I mean, if you're a nurse or any other profession and you work, you know, for a doctor's office, I mean, you know, that can be your public address for the business that you're working for, and unless it...
Do we have a copy of the supplemental sheet?
The checklist?
Yeah.
So we're... I do believe that I don't see any need for a personal address on the inspection agreement of the certified home inspector.
Right.
I think as long as we have a company name, a company address, I think that was the intent of this. The question is, and thank you, Mr. Dion, for bringing this up. The question is, do we need to change the standards in order to also include a company address, or is it inferred?
I think for clarification, it's always... nice. If it was a separate line, maybe you had name and certification number of the
or
certified home inspector.
Okay, we put out a supplemental sheet to explain to the home inspectors. We put out a supplemental sheet to...
Why are we getting an echo?
I don't know, but we put out a supplemental sheet to explain to the home inspectors. If you can put it back up, Kurt.
Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to share it so Mr. Dion can see it as well.
All right. To explain what we expect according to the standards, you know, like for instance, when they have a question about the address, and right on the supplemental sheet, it says number 4, firm address, okay? we want the firm mailing address to be included in the agreement. So I don't see that we need to change the form. We've already clarified on the supplemental that was approved by the board years ago that a firm address would be adequate.
So,
So is this a substantive policy statement?
No, this is an internal document that explains to the home inspectors when they're trying to understand what we expect them to do with the standards. It gives them a much better idea of what we're
doing. But
that's just the guide. That's just a guide, and that could change like that. It's
to be in the standards.
If it's in the standards, then it's you don't have to worry about clarity or anybody's misinterpretation of
right.
it.
Right, if you want to go through the problem.
And we can
well, because you are anyway. So.
The question is, do we need to change the standards to clarify this if we're accepting firm or company address names? Does the wording need to change is what I'm asking.
I would say yes, because 223 as it's currently read says the inspector. Regardless of what custom and practices, if I were looking at this and trying to see whether or not someone complied with the rule and they put a firm address, I would have a very good argument that they did not comply with the standard.
Okay, so in lieu of inspector on 221 or 223, we could maybe put firm or company address. What would you propose instead of the word inspector there?
I wouldn't remove the word inspector. I would add either a semicolon or a subpoint and says, or where the inspector is employed by a firm registered with BTR, the address of the firm, and the name and certification number of the inspector.
That's a lot.
Can I make a suggestion?
It is, but it's clear.
Yes, yes, Deanie.
What I would do, I think, is I would just take address out of that section and then create a new section that says the address of the inspector or the inspector's firm.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
Right, because you want the name and certification number of the inspector. So I think that reads well if you just took out the address, the name.
So another line
number.
Saying the address of the inspector or the inspector's firm?
Something like that.
Or you could say the business address of the inspector, which would include either one.
Okay.
That's true. Yeah. Yep.
All right. I'll kind of clean that up for inclusion in there if that looks like it'll work. Mr. Dion, we're kind of clarifying here in this. So you now are, you know, have been kind of clarified with that you do not need to have the home inspector's home address on, but the firm or company address will meet our current laws and rules, right?
Thank you. I just wanted clarification because I'm always trying to follow suit, and I joined a meeting recently and heard you're all getting your hands into this, and I'm really super interested in it because, like all my parallel guys, I tell them this is their Bible. This is where they start. So SOP is really important to me and my company and my business and whoever I explain stuff to. So.
Well,
I appreciate all the work that you guys are doing. I just wanted clarification on this particular point.
And thank you for bringing it up to us. Please, when we do send out the notice for the stakeholder meeting to further discuss, please take part in that. And we welcome you to help us out here at the BTR whenever your schedule allows. We really appreciate the help. Thank you, sir.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Dion.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Now, before we move along on this, wouldn't it be a lot easier just to say 2.23 to say the name, comma, business address, comma, and certification number of the inspector rather than add a whole new category, a whole new line, scratching a line, adding a line?
Just one new number?
All we really need to say is number 3, the name, comma, business address, comma, and certification number of the inspector. Add the word business.
We can consult the rule writer. Huh? Consult a rule writer for clarity.
It's just so ridiculous to add a number 7. It's ridiculous to, Mr. Green put it in a whole paragraph.
Either way works, so right? Either way works.
Yeah. Either way works.
Thank you.
Not our hill to die on right here.
Put the word
okay. So we're going to move on to 5.2, please, exterior 5.2. And this is an area of discussion we've had. This has to do with testing overhead garage doors for safety. And traditionally, garage doors have been tested for safety by exerting pressure when the door is closing, simulating a kid or a dog or a Volkswagen or something under it where the door would eventually stop and then reverse. It's an important safety feature. Newer safety guidelines now allow, and almost everyone's garage door, overhead garage door, has the infrared beams, which provide a secondary source of safety reversing. What we've seen some other standards go to is instead of requiring the resistance to be checked by allowing resistance to be checked by any available method, meaning by exerting resistance on the door while it's closing or breaking the beam while it's closing, making sure the door safety reverses. So that's what we and I am proposing here for it. But, you know, Peter has another angle on it, and I know he feels it's an important safety item. We always get to the point of how much do we burden inspectors with? When are we going overboard? When are we just doing something because that's the way we've always done it? And we're also, as we think about these SOPs, we're trying to build them for the next 20 years here,
right,
and the next 20 years of technology and what might happen. So I'm proposing that we remove the requirement for safety reversing testing by exerting pressure and move to any available method. Leave it open to the inspector. If they want to check it both ways, they can check it both ways.
Or just do the eye,
and then that would meet the minimum standards. But let's throw it up on the floor here and see if we can come to agreement on it.
Go ahead, Peter. Okay. There's two types of safety reversing mechanisms, and both of them have a different function. The tension reversing mechanism is when it comes down on something, it hits the resistance, reverses, and goes back up. All the new operators still have the tension reversing mechanism. The other is the eye sensor, which is a child safety mechanism. The child safety mechanism is the sensor simply because if a child is laying under the door, we put that down within 6 inches of the floor so that it senses the kid there and the door doesn't come down on the child. Okay? Now, I've never been a fan of dummying up our inspectors. This is to take responsibility off the inspector, especially for safety issues, is dummying up the inspector. He's giving him a way to cover his own six and get out of doing the proper job. Been 25 years, now I don't know what these other inspectors are doing, and I hear they're breaking them left and right, but in 25 years, I have tested thousands of these tension reversing mechanisms and never broke a door, all right? It's a matter of learning how to do it, all right? What we're doing, if we eliminate the tension reversing test, is the very first time that thing comes down on a car who is straddling the sensor, the eye sensor, and crushes the top of the car, the inspector's going to find him in a lot more trouble than if he actually broke the armature. So I'm all for leaving both of these tests in the standard.
Okay.
And I'm going to go one step further. When we put together the pool notes, okay, Mr. Schwartz and I went to pool associations to get them to sponsor our pool standards, okay? And the feedback that we got was, we can't sponsor this because you have too many exclusions in your pool standards. Now, exclusions are important for home inspectors, but it dummies down the technology, it dummies down the inspector himself, and the next thing we'll do is we're going to say that you don't have to open a door because you might pinch your toe. It really aggravates me that we're trying to pull this out.
No, I know, Peter, and I know you don't agree, but I also know that ASHI national standards in 2014 do not require the testing. They're basically any available method. So there was a lot of thought put into that from a national ASHI standard standpoint. and their outcome was to not require the resistance.
Okay, since I'm the tiebreaker, I just want to point out that the way it reads right now, you don't have to even check the eyes, right? It's describing that you will be testing it, meeting reasonable resistance. So there's actually a benefit to the new language that says any available method. You're going to, one way or another, this door has to be checked that it's going to reverse. Gives the inspector the leeway to choose which of the two they favor or is less risk or whatever. It's minimum standards. They can always do both every single time like you do and risk it. You know, I would do it both ways. But it does create more flexibility, and you could argue right now you could avoid checking the eyes because that's not a resistance test.
But we're not mandating using this rule change. We're not mandating that they check the infrareds. Like, they still could use
correct.
The other method.
Correct. Any available.
So I suppose I'm sort of leaning towards Mr. Leeds' position. I'm not sure just how much of an additional burden it would be to step in front of an infrared camera, which seems to be meeting a different problem. You know, his example of a child laying down is going to be a different problem than if we have a car in front and it has to meet that reasonable resistance first. The garage door in that situation isn't going to come all the way down to where it hits the infrared sensor. It's going to sense pressure and go back up. So it seems to me that those are meeting two different technical problems. Seem to benefit both the inspector in terms of his liability and the person's home being inspected if we require both and spell that out in the rules.
Well, I will tell you,
Inspector. May I ask a question?
Sure.
Why have you inserted the word vehicle after garage? I don't. That seems confusing to me, and I just
there
wanted
can be
to know what.
There can be man doors in a garage where you go to your side yard.
To differentiate it from a pedestrian door.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the one thing, just to get us like thinking a little differently as well, I don't even like the word or stop in there. There haven't been doors.
They haven't stopped.
And that's not, that never should have been acceptable mm-hmm. at all. So the word or stop should probably come out. That's unsafe today.
You're
for
right.
sure.
Yeah.
So and I'm not a fan of the vehicle door either because many of the vehicle doors that come into the garages don't have any of these systems. An overhead door is the only one that really has reversing systems on it. So overhead door would be a better word than vehicle door.
And I took vehicle because that's what Ashley had used to make it as a generic term.
So the larger overhead doors,
well, any overhead,
are, what door?
But
would
we're just
be
talking about the mechanisms that operate those.
Yeah,
that's all we're talking about here.
We're talking about the reversing mechanisms on those operators.
Right, on those vehicle overhead doors. But you don't think vehicle is clarification enough
there
on what door?
There won't be an overhead door for. There won't be a man door that's an overhead door.
Right.
Okay. But there will be vehicle doors that are not overhead doors and therefore don't have automatic safety.
Meaning they go
sideways?
Meaning
they're manual overhead
well,
doors?
Well, you got doors that do this, you got doors that...
Like barn doors.
But barn doors won't have an automatic safety reverse. The even the rollaways won't have an automatic safety reverse. The ones that do are your standard overhead doors.
Boy, I don't know.
Does it have to say
if you could,
I would say vehicle slash overhead. How about that? Do you guys love that?
Are you proposing we put the term overhead in there?
Overhead.
Okay, let me
for overhead.
Let me just make a note.
Vehicle and or overhead door. How about that?
How about horse overhead door?
I don't know. I just put in a roll up. I just put in an operator on it. Mm-hmm. It has to have safety reverse.
Too many types of doors.
I'm hard pressed to think of a horse overhead door that I've ever seen.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They're all for vehicles.
Okay, so
I like the using any available method. It gives the flexibility for the inspector to at least make sure that the car's going to trip. If you're worried about cars mm-hmm. a lot, mm-hmm. the cars are going, or a child, just make sure they're both going to work for it, right?
Well, they're going to, but okay, they're going to work when they're in motion. But these aren't safety devices for cars and children in motion. These are for safety devices for cars and children that are not in motion. So if somebody pulls into the garage halfway to run in and get something, and someone hits the overhead, okay, say he forgot his money, all right, he's going to be parked straddling that sensor. And if you're not testing, and if his tension reversing is not working, he's going to hurt his car. So I am so totally on the opposite side of the table on this. I am for testing both systems and making it mandatory, all right, to test both systems. So I can be overruled. I've been overruled many times in this forum, but I'm not for dummying down home inspectors. I'm for educating them and getting them to be better at what they do so that they can protect themselves. If we stop testing tension reversing mechanisms, we're going to have home inspectors in trouble in court.
It doesn't prohibit you from doing it.
It doesn't prohibit you, but you know what most of our home inspectors are doing. Only the basic minimums. And until they become seasoned at what they do, we got so many new ones, until they become seasoned in what they do, they're going to walk away from the things they don't have to do.
Do we have any knowledge of statistics or anything from ASHI about harm to the public based on doing this kind of test or not test?
From ASHI, no. You would have to go to the garage overhead door manufacturers. They may have done some kind of studies. They probably did at some point.
I would think that they would base a lot of their verbiage and things on statistics. I mean, if there was, you know what I mean? Like, Jaguars went away because of all the public harm and the lawsuits that were associated with the harm to the public.
That could be a factor. But we are kind of splitting hairs here on the type of safety reversing, and it's kind of specific. I'm not sure if we're going to have any numbers that we can lean on here.
But they took. There's been a lot of children crushed and killed and injured.
I figured that's why they took the road of
the child safety versus car safety.
Right. That's what ASHI did.
On the other hand, they also did not eliminate the tension reversing mechanism. They're in all the new units, even the ones without springs. You have tension reversing mechanism because it's important.
I know, and Peter, you've also had the opportunity to be jaded by years of sitting in EACs where you see what guys try to get away with. And I hear you.
But
can I throw in my 2 cents? I don't know if I'm allowed to throw in my 2 cents as a public.
Yeah, go for it.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure.
So I'll give you my little story here is that I went on my very first parallel. I brought my 2x4 on my first to my first parallel, and the inspector looked at me and he laughed and he goes, "You take that 2x4 home and you go and you burn it, because that's not how we test the garage doors. It's a reasonable resistance." So cut to just before COVID, there was a home show. I went to the home show and there's a garage door gal. I asked her some questions, picking her brain. She goes, "Do me a favor and test this garage door how you test it during your inspections." And I go, "Okay." So I do the beam test and then I do the reasonable amount of resistance as it's closing. And she said, "The garage door manufacturer says that you need to use a board, and what you're doing there is against what manufacturers recommend. And if you were to break that door, you just did something that's against what the manufacturer recommends on how to test the reverse mechanism." So ever since then, I still do the resistance test, even though I really want to implement back to the board, just because that's what the manufacturer recommends. And I have heard issues. The new garage doors are just cheap. They're just cheap. The builder grade stuff, they buckle in wind. So you have to check and make sure that there's no cracks. If there's a crack, you're going to buckle the door with just a reasonable amount of resistance. So I've trained all my guys to fully evaluate that door before doing a resistance test because we haven't gone to the manufacturer's recommendations yet, which is the board. So to ask all the inspectors to do a reasonable resistance could cause issues in the, hey, I did what the SOP said. Now there is also the thing that they need to evaluate the door prior to make sure that there's no cracks. I don't know. That's my two cents. I know I'm throwing it.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it brings up the good point. The manufacturer says put a 2x4 in there, but that's just not practical, and too many doors have gotten dented up on lower panels from that, and this, I don't know that the manufacturers have updated their recommendations on testing. I don't think it's fair to ask the inspectors to test it in both modes. I just feel testing the infrared beam plus testing resistance during closing is... I just think it's excessive.
I busted doors. When you totally jack a door, they can fall and still damage the car. I've had one fall on.
There was another point this gentleman, was that Mr. Dion? There was another point he raised, and that's over time they developed an experience, and they learned how to test those doors. They learned to check them out. They learned to be sure they don't have padlocks on them. They learned how to do the inspection, okay? And it just took experience, all right? And I suspect that if we still have seasoned home inspectors that are breaking overhead doors, that they can't learn. That's the only thing I can understand. Because that safety device for tension is very, very important. And the first time we get, and if we eliminate it and it doesn't get tested, we're going to be talking to home inspectors across this table to find out why they're being complained against because the overhead door dented the top of this guy's car. And we're going to say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it because one day in, November, we pulled that rule out of the standards.
What if we made it clear that the inspector has to describe their method of testing the garage door? Because when you can inspect the door all you want, when the spring breaks, you don't get notice. You can't see a little crease. You can't, we've done over 100,000 inspections. We've seen a lot, and they're expensive when you get called to replace what you just broke. So what if we required them to describe how they did it? And then
we can do that, but there's one more point I want to make. This board is here to protect the general public, and I do know that home inspectors are part of the general public, so we protect everybody. The associations generally have got a cover your six attitude where they write rules in order to protect the home inspector as well as the general public, but the home inspector takes seat one. In this committee, the general public takes seat one. And when we start pulling stuff out that protects the general public in order to protect the home inspector from breaking a door or going into a lawsuit, I think we're stepping down the wrong road.
Humans can be standing under the door when it breaks from the home inspector's test, right?
I understand all of that, but just because, yeah, I mean...
I've had them fall on my own car.
Okay.
When they break. Literally.
What were you doing testing your own?
No, I wasn't. It just decided to fail.
Spring breaks, right?
Spring broke. Yeah, they can break during these activities.
Mm-hmm.
And it pulled out of the rail and fell.
I did want to ask Mr. Starn real quick. Why is it your position that... I suppose I'm hung up on... I take Mr. Leeds' point. I appreciate Mr. Leeds' point. And I'm sort of left with, well, what exactly is the additional burden that we're imposing on home inspectors by requiring them to do it twice? I mean, a garage door takes 30 seconds to open and close.
Mm-hmm.
So for the uninitiated, what is that additional burden beyond that time?
The additional burden, obviously it takes time. There's a physical component of it where you have to exert pressure on it and you have to run past two or three cars to get to the third door that's opening because the button's over here and you're running over there because you have to get to the door before it closes and you don't want to break the beam because you're just testing the resistance. So now you got to get over there, try to straddle the beam and get under the door. So there's a physical component of it where you have to run over there, which at least you have to run over there for the beam anyway, but it's a lot easier just to have your foot kick the beam. There's a consideration of liability for the inspector. I've written three checks, and they start at $1,000 each by the trolley arm just ripping right off of the overhead garage door simply because I was the next one to check safety reversing by exerting pressure on it. I'm not quite in Mr. Lee's camp regarding if we leave it any available method or we update it with any available method that we're going to have a waterfall of any more complaints or any other, you know, increase in indiscretions by the inspectors. I don't believe that. I think an important point here is that the standards of practice, you know, Mr. Lee's brought up a good point on the societies and the standards and the purpose of the standards. They are meant to help mirror the standard of care that the home inspector takes while inspecting a home for someone, and that that standard of care.
You're supporting my argument. Better watch what road you're going down here.
No, I'm missing my point that I was trying to make.
Standards of care.
But the standard of care reflect what's actually happening out there, and I will tell you that many home inspectors are not even already checking safety reversing by pressure. They're just breaking the beam, and that's it.
And the garage door manufacturers have historically been inconsistent about how they describe they should be tested. Mm-hmm. And the National Association that's been around since 1976 made this change. It wasn't, and these are like real pinheads that sit in a room. Like, we're just minor league pinheads compared to these people.
No, I understand that. I confess I'm not super... The practical component of the inspection makes more sense to me, and I will say for the record, the manufacturer issue doesn't really swing me one way or another, because manufacturers are also covering their own best interest, and we need to alert the public if what in fact they have installed, produced by the manufacturer, fails to comply with what the public reasonably thinks it should do. I suppose your practical point about large garage systems...
It's arduous to test them on a good day. You've got a big, giant mechanical thing that you're trying to stop on a dime, mm-hmm. and there's a lot that goes on to that. And,
not by... Not true. And I'm going to just throw it out here at you again. We're not trying to stop this. We're trying to give it a reasonable amount of resistance. Now,
can you define that?
Well, no, I can't. But my fingers.
That's another problem.
My fingers can define it.
It's arbitrary.
There's a rather hilarious meme that's going around. It's a building being stood up by a 2x4, and it has it's labeled the entire American system of law, and this 2x4 that's holding it up is called the reasonable man. And that's essentially all of American law. So, no, I take the point that it's very hard to define what is reasonable.
You can't. But my fingers can. And that's due strictly to experience. I know what's reasonable.
Well,
and before it breaks, if it's going to break, it's more than reasonable.
Here's another nuance. Okay. So as it's going down, if you just like try and go like this, mm-hmm. it often will not reverse. Often. Mm-hmm. If you go like that, mm-hmm. it will... be a whole different test. Mm-hmm. These are just ridiculous tests, actually. That's why the manufacturers want something consistent.
Like a 2x4.
Mm-hmm. Everybody, you know,
if everybody's shoulders different.
Who weighs 98 pounds trying to do
stop
a garage door, yeah. It's very different than somebody, a strong guy or something, right. You know, or a strong gal. I agree. So I'm just going to, let's try and conclude this matter. Right. I would be on the side of the change that ASHI has adopted, and I would actually add in to remove or stop.
Or stop.
Because that's unsafe.
I agree with the or stop. I would go back to your previous suggestion and add a notice requirement that the inspector be required to describe what
describe
they did.
Describe how they did?
Yeah.
I'm all for that, too. But I also want you to know that your concerns... as they're coming across on this overhead door tension reversing mechanism, I want to go on record It seems to be trying to protect the inspector much more than trying to determine whether or not this is a safe door for the people who live in the house. I'm on record because I know I'm about
the civil courts can sort all that out, right? Mm-hmm. That's their job. Mm-hmm. We're the state agency.
But we're regulators. We're not here to protect home inspectors. We're regulators. We're supposed to be... associations are a combined effort of home inspectors to be sure that none of them get themselves in trouble. Regulators are supposed to be protecting the people and the property. And
Health, safety, and welfare of the public.
Right. And pulling out those safety devices, to me, is a step backwards. And I just want to be on record and say so.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for stating that.
Mm-hmm. And I would still do it. I would recommend every home inspector still check both.
All right. Well, then why are you pulling it out of the rules?
Because it's very cumbersome as is. It always has
running back and forth through the garage is really a ridiculous argument.
It's not a ridiculous argument because if something goes wrong, and I'm the attorney for the plaintiff who's, you know, 5-car garage and one of them doesn't function correctly, I'm going to be looking at these rules, and if the inspector didn't comply with them, that's going to be part of my standard of care argument.
What?
As to negligence.
Keep running back and forth through the garage?
No, I mean, I'm saying if in a circumstance where it's not practical to do that.
Well, the standards already give home inspectors the ability to say, I didn't do this because I thought it was unsafe. This is already in the standards. We can eliminate 90%.
But that's not a safety issue in this case. It's
Chairman,
a practicality issue.
Kind of the fly on the wall down here.
Yes, Roger.
Yeah, please.
Anyway, we were talking about standards, and we're going back and forth on standards and so forth. I have the ASHI standards right here.
Yep.
And on interiors, 10.1E, garage vehicle door, or let me state the whole thing here. The inspector shall inspect garage vehicle doors and garage vehicle door operators. It doesn't say it needs to be tested, just as we need to observe the function, the up and down motion.
Right.
So it just, I mean, there's a lot that is available for the inspector to make his own business decision on, you know, whether he's actually going to test the automatic safety reverse of either type.
Right.
You know, versus having to do it because it's in the standards. So
no, it's a good point.
I mean, personally, I'm a home inspector, of course. Personally, I'm going to be checking the auto reverse. I've had one incident in my 20-year career here of having a garage door, which I did not end up paying for. But I guess I've been lucky. I haven't damaged you know doors to the extent. To where they're, you know, having to be replaced by me. I'm sorry, the other guys haven't, you know, experienced that.
Not me, these guys.
But, I know, just maybe a few less words might be the...
Roger, are you okay with any available method wording? And then we'll require for the inspector to state the method of reversing?
I'm for exactly what's in the ASHI standards. Right.
Well, we can't say it word for word because the ASHI inspect is way different than the Arizona observe. So the inspect definition that ASHI uses in their glossary and theirs is different than the one, the inspect, the observe word that we used here in Arizona.
Right.
A couple different definitions in there. Again, ASHI is leaving it up to the inspector. We're proposing leaving it up to the inspector on any available method.
I don't know if any available method, because that sounds very ambiguous to me. You know, what do you mean any available method?
Well, there's only two that I'm aware of, other than actually moving a car under it. But there's only two available methods for most overhead doors for reversing, right? There's the beam or resistance. Okay. Is there a third one?
I'd be all set with any available two methods.
But, you know, Roger, if you've got some better wording for me, we can't use ASHI exactly because of the inspect, but if you've got better wording, send it over to me. But do you think we should require inspectors in Arizona, Roger, to test the doors by exerting pressure? Should that be a requirement?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No, I think that goes back to being in business.
Okay.
And there's a lot of things that we do that are not in the standards.
Right.
You know, that is, just makes good sense. I can't think of anything at the moment.
Okay. All right. Yeah, thank you. And please jump in here, because you're obviously a key player. All right, can we move on from this? So just briefly on 5.3, I put that in there in case we wanted to lose the substantive policy statement on fogged windows, but I know that's another agenda item on substantive policy statements, but I don't know which statements we have on the agenda that we're going to discuss. Is it the fogged window one?
It just says, yep. I believe, consider rescinding substantive policy statements related to home inspectors, which that's was made it wide open.
Yeah, I'd like to take the liberty to combine that with our discussion of this item here.
Okay. I don't think that's a bad idea. So
It would be 5F. We'd be removing that and inserting in the currently 5.3I. The only difference I would ask is that we say check the integrity of seals, comma, interior coatings, comma, efficiency gases. Because the presence or absence of gap, any argon inside these things, the low E coatings, that's clarified in the substantive policy statement, and it's not included in this more simple sentence here.
Could you read that again, please?
So the inspector is not required to observe the integrity of seals. Wait a second. That needs to say window seals. So the word window needs to be inserted?
Yeah. Well, it's currently in the current statement.
You're in the exterior section, right. Which includes wall cladding materials, garage doors. So I needs to say the integrity of window seals, comma, interior coatings, like low E coatings, comma.
Mm. Hold back. You probably ought to have multiple pane glass seals, because you do have these on doors as well as windows.
So, and I'm assuming where we're going with this, we want to lose this substantive policy statement in lieu of what we're doing here.
Yeah,
right?
We okay. want to comprehensively cover what we took a lot of time to create in a real
right.
brief
and
sentence.
Use some of that same verbiage then, okay.
And so I just called it efficiency gases. They'll fill them with, for those who don't know, they'll fill those with argon, which is a barrier to thermal transfer of heat. So those are the things that home inspectors are not going to be
window
able to
seals,
check.
Interior coatings, efficiency gases.
That's it, comma, that's it. And then between multi-glaze windows.
Okay, we probably don't need windows in there.
So we don't need
once.
Window. Yeah, I'm sorry.
We've got windows in there.
What an honor.
Between.
So multi- just.
Okay.
So after seals, just comma, interior coatings, comma, efficiency gases, comma. And I think we can eliminate 5F, which we try to do every time we can if we're creating a standards change.
5.3F?
It's a substantive policy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
Back on
apologize
okay.
for that.
All right. That. Any comments on that? And again, we know that while the inspector is required to observe adverse conditions, and it's possible that a fogged window could be a visually adverse condition, we're not requiring. What we're talking about here is the minor fogging and having it the inspector be responsible for, you know, closely inspecting the integrity of all this, which does go way beyond our scope here. So that's what we're trying to accomplish, not required to. Okay?
Yeah.
We all right?
Does
let's
that
move
make
on.
Sense, Peter?
Yeah, I'm off.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Is your substantive policy statement filed with the Secretary of State's office? I assume it is.
Yes.
Yeah. It should always be.
So, you know, there's a process when you get rid of one to rescind it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It usually goes before the board, Dini, and then the board makes a vote to rescind the substantive policy statement.
Okay, and then you file that rescission with the Secretary of State's office?
Correct.
Okay, good.
So are we saying it will sunset on its own?
No.
No, it has to go before the board.
Okay. All right.
No, but when we need to put it on a sidebar to be sure that we that gets handled.
Okay. Yeah. Once these.
But we don't want to do that, of course, until the rule is changed.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. So 7.3. Thank you. Want to strike spas? That's interesting.
So I brought this up because, frankly, so I'm 7.3.E.6. I struck that out because I couldn't, and I put disgust by it because I couldn't figure out a good darn reason why it was in there originally, and I needed someone to enlighten me. So we're talking about the inspector not required to observe spas except as to function flow and functional drainage. I assume we're probably
7.3.6.
I think, whirlpool wasn't this tubs, meant to be right? jetted tubs? Yeah. I think this was meant right there, to refer right? to jetted tubs, yeah. right?
Yeah, that's what they were yeah. used to call spas.
So I guess I wanted to run by you if this is still to germane fix. To what we're doing.
I don't think so.
And I don't want it to be confused with the pools and spas, which are the real spas. So if we meant jetted tubs, we should say that yeah. or remove this. And I wanted to get your opinion on that, guys.
Well, I run them all.
Well, yes. right, but what should we have in the standards? And do we, if is leaving that in there serving the consumers and the inspectors here?
If we take it out.
Not required to observe spas except for functional flow and drainage. What? It means nothing for me for the most
functional
part.
Functional flow and drainage has to be checked anyway.
That's anyway.
Is so, that normal if you go into a home that has
well,
a jetted
yeah,
tub?
Yeah, every fixture has to be checked, and we're already required in plumbing to check functional flow and drainage. That's pretty well nailed
that's
down.
That's not the question. Fine. What was your question?
Well,
are we checking them anyway?
I've never had a jetted tub, so I'm just asking, is that normal that you
right,
would...
If we,
we would test that.
That would be national standard. Like, you'd have to put water enough in the tub that you could
right.
turn the jets on
right.
it and see if they're working.
Okay, if we if we pull it out, is it going to be interpreted as that we have to fill the tubs and test the jets?
No.
I mean, well, the whole idea of putting it in was simply to tell your home inspector they don't have to fill the tub to test the jets.
And that's what I'm trying to clarify, if that still
that's
makes
a good
sense.
Point.
So maybe you want to just say you don't have to fill the tub and test the jets. You know, you might put in there jetted tubs.
So maybe if that was the intent, Peter, maybe we just need to clarify that in the wording.
That spas are jetted tubs.
Right. But I don't want to get into outside spas above ground. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into any of that with this. Mm-hmm. I just want to address this as a... more of a master jetted tub kind of deal, right? Is
right.
really where
that's
this comes
is.
Into play.
Although I saw it in a hall bathroom.
Well, yeah, it can be in a hall bath. But
so jetted tub, just change that and pull out the functional flow and functional drainage.
Maybe you don't motor components and jetted tubs, or
that's a lot of words.
Well, actually, the way it reads now. Just clarifies you still have to check
the mechanical
functional flow and functional drainage.
Yeah. Right.
But otherwise, you don't. Right? So,
so
if we just
we
change spas to jetted tubs.
And leave it alone.
And leave it alone.
Yeah. And, you want the
and not say jetted tub motor, just jetted yeah. tubs.
Well,
this is what's not required
right.
to be.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, how about mechanical?
Mechanical
jetted tubs,
functions.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as a non-mechanical jetted tub?
Yeah. One that just has bubbles that comes up, right? You just see those
yeah,
bubbles, no jets, just bubbles that
well,
comes
those
up?
Those are bubbler tubs. They still have a blower. That's mechanical.
That's true.
But
mechanical function.
The only non-mechanical jetted tub I have is the one at home where my wife just keeps jumping on the pump. And the air keeps
you know, I'm going to lean towards just having this read jetted tubs. We already have to do functional flow and drainage. If someone has a better idea, I don't know about mechanical, Roger. I think we're just going to go jetted tubs on this. That's pretty.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and that would also cover the blower bubbler thing, really. Okay.
Unless you want to put bubbler in there.
Nah.
What do they call that? I think it's a bubbler tub.
Yeah, it's like a bubbler. All right.
We'll be looking that up after.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank
We're gonna
you.
We're going to Google
that.
We have no idea what that is.
And then 7.3E7. is, it says solar heating systems. That should probably, this is a plumbing section, that should probably say solar water heating systems.
Well, you're in the plumbing section.
Yeah,
correct. We are in the plumbing section, so we need the term water in there.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because since we're in plumbing, we're just talking water here, I guess.
Then,
I would
then
say it's one again. Word for a lot of clarification.
Then
I
look
think
at C1.
Yeah,
look
I
at C1.
Say.
I would too.
Look at 7.1C1. Why is the word water in there then?
Take it out.
Oh, we're putting it in.
So not solar water heating, system. Just to be clear?
Yes.
Okay. That sounds good. Solar water heating. Thank you. Okay, eight. Good stuff here in electrical. And frankly, let's have the discussion, I guess, on solar equipment and see if we can. There's two big discussions that are left here, the solar and then the GFCIs and how we're dealing with that. Those are the two main discussions largely left here. And we'll see if we can get through this efficiently. So solar systems. Clearly here in electric, we're just talking about photovoltaic systems, solar panels meant to
generate
electricity. And that is an entire system that feeds into normally the main electrical service panel in the home. So that entire system, right up to the connection point for the main panel, that is what contains the solar system. It's the panels, all the stanchions and brackets, it's all the conduits, all the sub-panels dedicated for solar, the inverters that make it go from DC to AC current, and then anything else that's specific just to solar. What ASHI National has done is they've disclaimed the entire system, saying the inspector is not required to inspect the solar system from end to end. That's what I'd like to do for Arizona. I think it makes the most sense. And there's another school of thought that says, why not inspect what we currently have in our SOPs, like wiring, like exposed conduit, like making sure the inverter is not falling off the wall, I guess, or if there's an obvious defect maybe with a solar panel. I happened to see one near a golf course that had all kinds of golf ball dents on it. Of course, I noted it, and I said, inspection limited on this system. But the concern is, frankly, liability. Liability for the state and the inspector. Once you start inspecting part of the system, and then you try to limit it, you know, the inspector can limit the scope within their report and saying, okay, I inspected the conduit in between the inverter and the panels, but my inspection was limited to that. I didn't do the rest of the system. It's another one of these that's fraught with danger. I don't know of any current standards that include the entire solar system. The question is, do we include any of the components or do we disclaim all of it? And I'm leaning towards disclaiming the entire system, and I think Peter may have another opinion on it, which we are happy to hear.
Photovoltaic systems. You can't walk away from the whole system because you have a breaker for your photovoltaic and your main panel. Okay, so the systems are intertwined. You can walk away from the efficiency of the system, you can walk away from the operation of the system, you can walk away from everything except the physical parts of the system that you can see. Mm-hmm. You're going to have conduit running from your main panel to your secondary panel, you're going to have panels on the roof that could be causing roof leaks, they could be broken. You could have exposed conduit or wires running up to the roof, which you're going to have to take care of. So I'm not a fan of eliminating of walking away from the entire system. Okay, that only protects home inspectors, doesn't protect clients. I am, on the other hand, in favor of disclaiming the entire system for its functionality.
So limiting the scope, you're saying?
Limiting the scope. Yeah.
to those components that we normally would look at.
Right.
What you just described is a need for a separate set of standards for those, because they have a bunch of components in between the breaker and the last panel, mm-hmm. and you either have to jam it all in here, or it really deserves its own, which I don't even know if there's a standard in existence
in the
country.
David, I don't see the need for that. Well, most of the equipment you're not going to be able to access because it's got a padlock on it, okay?
I think you do. They're complex.
So you have, I'm talking about falling back simply to your main electrical concerns, okay? We have to address wiring, we have to address conduit, we have to address the panel, the breaker panel, stuff like that, that you're going to be into.
The panel you're already checking, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So as soon as it hits the outside of the panel mm-hmm. and goes in conduit mm-hmm. to be exclusive to the photovoltaic system,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that's what we're talking about excluding. Anything once it hits that panel enclosure,
mm-hmm.
that's required.
That's the normal place for the cutoff. On the other hand, when we cut those things off, but we have to address physical problems that we see with those things. You're going to have conduit running up the side of the building. You should be addressing
there's,
the condition
there's
of
problems with those that we don't even understand.
Well, no, those problems you don't. I'm saying you have to walk away from. That's the functionality of it.
So you have to define what is in the scope and what's outside the scope. To a high degree on a very complex system.
No, I don't see why. All you have to do is disclaim the functionality of the photovoltaic system. I think you should still be looking at the components of that as part of your electrical and handled under your electrical as written.
They're extremely complex with inverters and
I'm not
talking
about
all kinds
about,
of possible
I'm
configurations
not,
with batteries.
I'm not talking about configurations. You're not catching what I'm saying. I'm saying that you just have to look for adverse conditions that are obvious to you. Open conduits. If a conduit's running up the side of the building with wires in it, okay, and the wires are exposed, I feel that you need to address
then
that.
The inspector has to report on it because it's an adverse condition.
Adverse
and keeping
condition,
in mind that most inspectors are inspecting doing this stuff anyway. You
right.
and I are doing it anyway. If
that's,
we see something obvious, we're going to call it.
That's
what we're
point.
Talking about is where do we set the bar on requirement, right?
Well, that would is already required in our standards under electrical for exterior wiring, okay? Exterior wiring has to be addressed.
True, unless I disclaim the entire system in my report, which
well,
I can do.
But then if you disclaim the physical aspects of the system in your report, you're not doing your client the justice of saying, hey, when your child walks by here, he's going to get electrocuted.
Right.
You know?
I tell my client I'm doing a visual observation on this. It's limited.
That's what you want. And that's also what we do in our entire electrical system. We don't check you don't check amperage with amp probes.
Yeah.
You know, we don't check voltage with voltmeters. What we're doing is doing a physical inspection of the equipment. And I don't want to walk away from solar if we're going to disclaim all of those physical aspects.
Right. Roger, I'd like you to weigh in at some point on this. You know, whatever your take is on solar, I don't know if you have a feel for it. If we should get into part of it or none of it, I guess is the question.
Just what's in the main panel or the distribution panel or wherever, you know, up to that point. You know, once when it leaves that panel, that's part of the solar system.
And you don't think any of it should be required for the inspector, or do you think the inspector should do a limited inspection on it that be
well,
required?
Well, anything that's obvious, you know, like loose conduits or something falling off the wall, a panel falling off the wall, sure. I mean,
that's going to happen all the time.
Right.
But here's another thing. This is not unlike a pool or a spa. We don't make the schools teach on this. We don't have any questions in the exam on this.
Mm-hmm. What's there to teach?
You've never been to a seminar from an expert on solar, huh?
No, I'm saying.
They're
what?
So complex, you can... I'm just telling you. There's so many things
you're also
that are installed wrong.
Me.
The installation's being
that's
wrong.
Not what I'm,
getting sued for the installation being incorrect.
What I'm saying to you, David, is exactly what Roger said. You got conduit falling off the wall, you need to address it. I don't care if it's going to the neighbor's
house. Then define
house.
That. Then let's put that in. If conduit's falling off the wall, and there's a broken panel, that's really all we can do with them,
it's
right?
It's already in
it's all
standard.
We can do with them, is
so
it not?
It's already, so if I can interject, if mm-hmm. it's already in the standard that you're already doing a visual inspection of electrical, right. and by taking this out, by putting what we're putting in here, we're just removing any operational or efficiency inspection, are you all just talking past each other? Because I feel like we're addressing both concerns with this edit.
We are talking past each other.
Okay, that sounds like a reasonable resolution. This sounds this sounds like a good edit then.
One thing that's odd is it's solar photovoltaic equipment is inserted as an item that must be observed.
If it was going in,
right.
If
I'm not
in.
In favor of that at
right.
all.
I was trying to give equal time to both options.
Perfect.
Here.
Okay. So they're okay. both on here.
Okay. So then I okay.
And then okay.
So.
I remember the old days. In the old days, these were the Dalrymple days. There was an opinion that you have your standards, but if the inspector inspected it or comments on it in any way, he inspected that entire system. And it's like, that would kill us right now, you know?
Unless he limited himself. And so the example is irrigation is not, you know, landscaping irrigation is not on our SOPs, but if we note a defect with
something
it, and we don't limit our scope, then we bought the whole system kind of thing.
They have the right
to
assume.
And that probably came from the AG's office at the time. We bought the system. If we say we looked at this, we need to tell them we didn't look at that if we opened up the can of worms. So
Colin, your example of noticing golf ball damage to mm-hmm. panels, which normally wouldn't be something you need to report on solar panels,
it
right?
was an obvious adverse condition. I couldn't not report on
and
it.
And so how does... Forgive my ignorance, because I don't really know. But so, how did you report that? I mean, you notice it, and you didn't necessarily have to, but you put it in the report as
in the electrical section of my report, under the electrical service section of the report, is obvious damage to the panels, and recommending obviously a qualified contractor come and review and the cost to cure.
So, just as basically, you observed this.
I observed an obvious adverse condition on it, and had I not gone up on the roof, I wouldn't have seen it.
But I'm sure your notation also disclaimed everything else about the system.
It did. It's limited.
You limited inspection. I'm just going to tell you, you have a broken pan.
Right, but if I didn't limit myself, I probably bought the whole solar system. If I didn't limit myself,
and
a good attorney would bolt me right to that entire system.
And home inspectors need to know to do that.
Of course.
They need to know that they need to address that broken panel
right.
and not the rest of the system. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
They need to be able to physically look at the equipment, not to ascertain what it does. They might not even know what it does.
I think
just to be sure it's not falling off the walls.
Yeah, I
don't think we need to put anything in the standards for that. It's already in our electrical section.
I think we're set. Yeah, because the way we got over that hurdle a little bit was the legal theory that a police officer cannot go to a burglary call and walk over a dead body and ignore it.
Right.
So a home inspector cannot walk past something that catastrophically bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's an adverse condition. We have to report on it.
Note.
Right.
So
should we just clarify it's a visual inspection? Should we say
I think we should just take it right out. I mean, the easiest thing to do here would be to say that the home inspector is not responsible for inspecting photovoltaic systems and leave it out, because everything else that is even involved with the photovoltaics is already in the standards under electrical. Conduit, breakers, disconnects, things things that could, you could physically see are wrong are already covered in our.
So you're saying we should say we're, the inspector is not required to
inspect
photovoltaic systems.
Boom, done.
Which means the entire system. So I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, you see, you're not understanding. Because once you walk on the roof and found a broken panel, you're covered from some other. Once you walk on the roof and see a conduit separated and inner wires exposed, you're not in the photovoltaic system. You're back in your electrical system. You already have to talk about broken conduits and wires exposed. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So why confuse everybody by getting in there and trying to determine exactly what on a photovoltaic system you don't want to inspect?
I don't want to get into it. I don't want to do the whole thing.
Eliminate it from your standards and just go fall back on your electrical system for the things.
We
that
have
you
to
on.
Say the word solar in here somewhere. It's an
why?
Important. We can't. It's an important
well, no,
component
I'm saying,
of the home. We
photovoltaic
have
solar systems are not included. A home inspector is not required to inspect photovoltaic.
So are we in heated agreement here?
So yes. In system, so
that's
the operation of.
I don't know why David was arguing.
The operation of.
Yeah, go ahead, Roger.
The operation of photovoltaic systems.
Well, how about the not only the operation but the adequacy?
Condition?
How
are you saying?
There
condition?
You go. There's another.
Well,
good
condition
answer.
Is something you're going to see.
Observe. We would use the. We would fall back on observe the system, right?
And it's
that,
already,
that's our.
And they're part of an electrical
term.
System, so they fall in our electrical. The function of the photovoltaic, the adequacy of the photovoltaic, are things we don't want to get involved.
Right.
With, you see, or
this
even
money.
What the different equipment does. All right, the resistors and the transformers or anything else they might have in there. All right, you just want to be able to physically look at the equipment.
Okay, so then we would. We would remove B on shall observe.
B what?
Is this 8.1B?
8.1B, thank you. So we would remove solar photovoltaic systems.
Take it right out.
And then under, and then I'm not required to observe solar photovoltaic systems. Not required to observe, right?
So we're have? Inserting solar photovoltaic systems under 8.3.
That would go under 8.3. I would
8.3F.
8.3F. Okay.
F6. Just take the.
So you already had
I already
a condition
had it
for
in
that
there
okay.
as a proposal. Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's
see,
the alternate.
Yeah, that's the alternate.
Okay.
Which it on the other page?
Yes, it's the next page.
Oh.
Or
adequacy and operation of solar voltaic system. Boom, done.
Yep, that makes sense.
All right, so moving on. So, you ready to move on, David?
Well, what if in the five just above it says geothermal, wind? Can we not just call them all or solar
alternative
wind or? Renewable.
We can have a generic statement on that renewable energy.
That includes solar and everything else. So, geothermal, wind, other solar and other renewable energy systems. What about something like that?
Yep.
And then we don't need six at all.
Is photovoltaic renewable?
Yes, yeah. It's classified.
Is it classified as a renewable?
Yeah.
So then it could just simply be as simply done as adding solar comma after the comma after wind and then take out six, right?
What section are we on?
8.3F6 and 5.
That's on the draft though, right?
Yes.
Okay, I don't have a copy.
Yeah, then you can dump the adequacy
on the screen
and the operation
as well.
Because
so tell me then, David, geothermal... Just wind and
solar.
Scratch and six if you haven't already.
Right.
And then five, just say geothermal, comma, wind, comma, insert solar if you want a comma after
right.
that, put a comma.
Right.
Well, if we're trying to give it the same effect as six currently has, I would say also insert the adequacy or operation before geothermal.
Or...
Yeah, because we got the same argument if, say, you got a wind... turbine that's falling down. You know, you're going to have to. You
so
can't.
That means you've got to inspect it, the entire system.
It's like saying you don't have to do operation and adequacy only, but I don't know how you differentiate that from condition, right? How do you? Can't you just, we don't do those.
Yeah, I don't mind. Where they're at. I don't mind, but eventually someone's going to get in trouble.
So you think, the question is, do we need the adequacy or function words in there?
I would say no.
If we're trying to give it the same effect as 6, I would, you know, for consistency's sake, in all of these cases, we're going to be observing physical condition and obvious physical adverse conditions. So what we're excluding in all cases is the adequacy or operation of the system. So all I would suggest is incorporate solar into 5 and the adequacy or operation also into 5.
I thought we were just talking about take them out entirely, not just adequacy and operation.
Where we're not... it's clarifying what we're not doing here is what you're...
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's trying to clarify what we're not doing. The question is, do we need the adequacy or operation words when we're saying the inspector is not required to observe?
So I would say...
If we said not required to observe solar, then now do we need adequacy and operation? It's kind of inferred, right? We're not required to do the system.
Well,
do we need adequacy and operation?
And actually, you're right, because obvious physical defects are covered by other standards. Yeah, ignore me.
So maybe we can live without that. We'll just put solar in there and maybe see if that...
Yeah, and strike 6. And just to reinforce that, any problems that you might find other than adequacy and operation are going to show up in the standards someplace else. Okay, it's going to be electrical, it's going to be plumbing, it's going to be something. Even if it's hot water, if it's leaking off the roof through a solar.
Right. That's well taken. I appreciate it.
It'll be done in the plumbing section.
All right, so let's move on, Mr. Chair.
If you have time, and just so everybody knows, or at least you're the one remaining holdout from staff, the way as I understand it, the surveyors addressed a big standards change, knowing that these kind of arguments occur, is that, and we can only gather together when we're here, kind of thing, in a quorum and in an open meeting, that they would just stay one more hour after a normal meeting. We know what our normal meeting times are, and they would stay a little extra just to hammer this stuff out, because this is going to keep going on. We're not completing it today like I had hoped.
Certainly, it's usually assumed that you guys will be discussing it for some time, because you will make changes, come back with those changes, and re-review.
Yeah. So.
And I can't stay much longer. I got to write a report this afternoon.
Right. So, do you have time for the next item?
Well, let's at least hit this GFCI. Can we at least hit that, and then we'll maybe table the rest of this, okay. Mr. Chair, if we may.
Sounds good.
8.3.
Yes. So we're. We're on item G as in George, 8-1 George here. So we have these new components called AFCI, arc fault circuit interrupters, a different kind of circuit protection that is now in all new homes. And the newer electrical standards are requiring it on many 15-amp circuits in the home. So our standard of care is essentially to not test these. There's a test button on the breaker. And the current standard of care is most inspectors don't test them. Some inspectors, like us, will test them on vacant homes, because if you're testing something, you're dropping a circuit. You're dropping an entire circuit, and you don't really know what's on that circuit. And it could be grandma's ventilator. You don't know what's on the circuit. Or the fish tank motor that won't reset now, and you killed the fish. So...
Valuable fish.
The valuable fish. They became more valuable once
they
were floating
more
sideways,
now.
Too.
There's emotional support fish. You've caused emotional damages. You've got...
So we have to address AFCI circuit protection in the standards. And we also have this other type of circuit protection called GFCI, ground fault circuit interrupter, a different type of circuit protection that we have commonly seen with the test reset buttons in kitchens and bathrooms, exteriors and garages. The current standard is to require the inspector to test all GFCI.
Doesn't say all.
Tests. It doesn't say all.
Or wait,
we're
maybe
present.
It does.
We're present.
We're present.
Thank you.
And so, and so in a GFCI, maybe you'll see one in your bathroom where you live.
Mm-hmm.
That anything downstream of that will also shut off when you shut that off. Could control the garage, the outside, elsewhere. So we have historically interpreted that to mean if it has the buttons on it, you're going to test that one. You don't have to sort out everything downstream because you can't see it. I don't know where they are. I don't know. There can be a bunch of them. So that's been the historic interpretation.
Right. And frankly, it's always fraught with danger hitting that button and just praying that you're not turning something off, like the Wi-Fi for the guy who's in the office on a conference
stock
call.
Trade.
Yeah, in the middle of a stock trade. You don't know what you're turning off as a circuit. So that's why we don't test AFCIs, and that's the danger currently with testing GFCI outlets. With GFCIs, frankly, it's a lot of times more fraught with danger. These historically have been in important areas, in the wet areas of the home. And the standards, which I think I crossed out saying 6 feet, I think I got rid of that 6 feet
right.
from the sink.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
crossed that out as a requirement because that is a reference to an old electrical code. What makes the most sense is to kind of group the AFCI and GFCI together, and I'm proposing now we not require the inspector to test any available GFCI devices. What we're seeing now with GFCI devices is they've kind of taken an era of increased complexity regarding where they are and what circuits they protect. So now we see GFCI circuit breakers, the test buttons on the breaker, we see it commonly in pools. And so we're required by our current standards to hit that test button, not knowing really what's on the end of that circuit. We know we're dropping a breaker now. We're dropping an entire circuit. We have no knowledge fully what's on there. We talked about, you know, the GFCI circuits, specifically the garage circuits, have all kinds of important stuff plugged into them, besides the fact that we can't find the reset buttons, which is not specific here. But the point is, I believe it's arduous to require now that every single GFCI mechanism be tested. I think that's arduous. The ASHI national standards are not requiring that in the 2014 national standards. I believe we should leave it up to the inspector's discretion. And Mr. Leeds is going to bring up, a good counterpoint. Then these guys are not going to, if we did that, then these guys are not going to touch any of the buttons, you know. And I realize, you know, there may be a little more leeway where we would be allowing the inspectors by not requiring them to mash that button and then pray they didn't turn off something important in the seller's home. I believe most inspectors, especially the kitchen and bathroom ones, they're right there. They're super easy to test. I think for that, you know, and we can't pick and choose which ones. We need to make a blanket statement. There's just too many unknowns involved with dropping circuits, any circuit, AFCI, GFCI. It's just way too fraught with danger. And we're also trying to build these standards for the next 20 years. So where are GFCIs going now? The other thing we're seeing is combo circuit breakers. They're arc fault circuit and GFCI circuit. So now the current standards are requiring the inspector to test those combo GFCI, AFCI, because it's in the standard and it says right on the breaker. So now there's more breakers we're supposed to drop because
of that. It's in conflict with itself too, because we don't have to trip.
I know, it is conflicting now because it's a newer type of electrical. But again, we're trying to build these for the next 20 years. These circuits are only gonna get, are they gonna get more complex or less complex? Mm-hmm. We know they're only gonna get more complex. They're gonna have more Wi-Fi things plugged into them. It's just gonna get more involved. That is my case for removing the requirement to test the GFCI mechanism on.
Can I ask a point of clarification?
Yeah,
for
sure.
GFCIs, those are going to, the one of the differences, as I understood from your presentation, is GFCIs are going to be located at various points in the home mm-hmm. versus AFCI, which is going to be at one location.
That's a fact.
Yeah, that's true. AFCI is going to be in a panel.
So going back to David's earlier point concerning notice requirements, would it be appropriate to say for GFCIs the inspector should note where they are?
Well, we have to observe their presence at a minimum.
Right, but it says presence or absence of the protection. I would say if we're going to, I would say it would be appropriate for GFCIs if they're in multiple locations to ask the inspector to say, and they're located here, 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 and here.
We can't see them. Yeah. Like garages especially are catastrophic. We don't, you know, it's just.
They typically are.
yeah, that's trouble for mm-hmm. GFCI for sure. What I don't understand is, so if the requirement was we have to describe the presence or absence of...
That's a new comment.
Then what, it only takes one, you know? Like, if one GFCI is there, then we note GFCI protection existed in the house or so. Like, what would our actual comment
be? I mean, at a minimum, we have to note that GFCI, AFCI protection is present in a home. Now, do we go the next step and say, where is it present? AFCI like, was in the panel, GFCI, we had kitchen and bath.
But I'm just thinking, there. Like right now what we do is we know that a lot of homes don't have it perhaps in the kitchen, right?
Right.
Kitchen's not protected.
Right.
So we'll note that.
Right.
You know, you have GFCI protection. Well,
how would you know that?
I know
that. Because I'm popping.
Because you're pushing your button.
We're allowed to go beyond the standards.
Right. Right.
But we're trying to set a minimum bar because this area is getting very complex.
It's getting complex. Now, are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm all for not testing arc fault systems because mm-hmm. the arc fault systems are going to show up on every breaker eventually. Okay? The newer houses have already got half the panel or three quarters of the panel arc fault. All right? Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of not testing ground faults. All right? Because ground faults are a safety issue. When it comes to wet areas, all right? It used to be very simple.
And arc faults are safety also. They wouldn't be there if it wasn't safety.
Yeah, but they're not safety in wet areas, okay?
Okay.
And personally, I think the arc fault was a political thing, all right? The NEC decided that they needed to make changes, and someone came up with this great arc fault system, which they shouldn't be putting everywhere because it's just causing vacuum systems, so it's shutting off breakers, all sorts of things. But the ground fault is important to me when it comes to kitchens, bathrooms, exteriors, garages, basements, crawl spaces, utility rooms. Right. Okay? These are still important to me because these are your wet areas. Yeah. So we've got to come up with some type of a compromise. Otherwise, we're dumbing down our home inspectors once again. If you're looking, which is one of your favorite statements, we're looking towards the future.
Right.
We're looking also towards dumbing down home inspectors so they're not going to be able to handle the future. We need to know.
You can't handle the future.
Right? I can't handle the present.
We are mixing so many metaphors.
I am so confused in the present. I'm afraid of the future.
I'm so afraid of the future.
But we have to come up with a way of telling the home inspector that he needs to test our ground fault, not our fault. I like the presence of our fault.
Right.
But testing ground faults in the wet areas where they're important, and we have to give him an out so that if there's a million other things on that system that he doesn't have to do.
So you'd like to see him left in a kitchen and baths?
Kitchens, baths, and garages. I know you guys.
Well, then that's the whole ball of wax anyway. So.
Well, not necessarily, because you also have washing machines now on ground fault. Mm-hmm. You have your water
heaters,
washers on ground fault. Your overhead door is now on the ground fault. Okay, if you trip the ground fault in the garage, you're not going to be able to open your overhead door. So I think that also this committee ought to send a letter to the NEC and start complaining about some of these issues.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
First time your overhead door doesn't work and you forgot your key, you're in big trouble. Okay.
Well,
we know when it comes to ground faults that even our monsoons are powerful enough with electromagnetic storms to trip them off. All right. And maybe it's a matter of educating our clients. If you actually come down and trip off a ground fault system, and it shuts off his computer, maybe you ought to tell him to keep that damn computer off the ground fault system. Put it on an arc fault system instead, because we don't have to test those. You see what I'm saying? And anybody who's plugging into the bathroom or kitchen with their computer and then yells at you because they didn't save their work, you got a case against them.
So why don't we require the inspector to hit the test button on a smoke detector? Why don't we
because
require
of,
that?
Because it might work today, but not tomorrow.
How about the GFI?
Well, GFIs have the same issue. They might work today, but not tomorrow.
So, but with two different standards here. We're not requiring smokies, but we are in GFIs, and they're important.
That's a good point, Paul. I have to think about that.
Think about that. Mm-hmm. Roger, any thoughts on GFCI requirement?
I don't like the idea of requiring testing of arc faults.
No.
Right. Yeah, I think we're all in the same camp on that one. The question is, should we require the GFCIs?
Well, I only test them where I can see them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
Yeah, I mean,
I know.
But you don't know where it really controls.
You have no idea where the circuit goes.
So I guess my greatest concern, because over the years, over 33 years, I know we've paid for two freezers full of elk.
I've got one.
At least.
One full of meat.
At least.
I paid for.
Very expensive.
That totally happened to me in a house in Texas that we sold. The home inspector tripped it.
No.
We had a deep freeze and everything went bad.
Your own meat got...
Oh, well, no. I hunted, no. That I hunted at the grocery store, yeah.
You could buy elk at the grocery store?
In Texas.
Awesome.
I was just telling Kurt that. I'm like deep freezes.
I would be afraid to take it out. For sure, but I think the way it exists,
we have to
now
we have to come up with compromises.
Here's a little bit of a compromise. Is what dawned on me is okay. What's the worst that happens when I can't find the reset? I'm most worried about a fridge or freezer on it. For me, mm-hmm. That's my biggest fear. So for that reason, we do have something in here saying we can exclude things if we describe why we excluded it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I would teach my guys, if there's a fridge or freezer in that house, we are not touching a GFCI, period. If there's one in the garage, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the real chronic problem we tend to have.
Mm-hmm. We do have some other issues with ground faults that we do
so
have
we could
to
leave
test.
It almost as is and live with it, couldn't we? Because we're never
we definitely could. And I, you know, I see the value in both, but...
To take it out is just like, gosh, we get to walk by all GFCIs. I'm a little scared of that.
The thing about tomorrow is inspections are a snapshot in time. So when you test the ground fault protection today, you're not responsible for tomorrow.
Oh, no, I know that.
You know? So, and of course, we all know that. But there are ground faults that are very important, such as the pool light. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, if you're running 110 volts to a big body of water, you're going to want to have a ground fault that works.
Absolutely.
Okay?
And we all test those. The question is it part of the standard?
Well, that is part of our... It is part, to test that is part of our...
I know it is currently.
Okay?
I think it should stay a little bit. It should stay as is. Because
and the home inspector is just going to have to get smart.
And yeah, and then if you see a condition that's high risk... You see that somebody's working from their home, I'm excluding them.
And you put
I'm
it
not
in
testing
the report.
Them.
And this is what most of our newer home inspectors are not grasping yet, but they will over time, is to put words into the report that protects them from the things they can't do.
Right.
Okay? They're working off a standard formats that we try to tell them all the time, you've got to add words to these in order to protect your client and yourself. And if they're not adding those words, well, they're going to learn the hard way. So it's up to the associations now who protect home inspectors to teach them these things.
Roger, you have any thoughts as far as if we should keep the requirement in the SOPs to test GFIs? Any feel either way?
Well, I was just looking there to see exactly what the wording was. I can't find it.
Yeah, all observed GFI mechanisms are supposed to be tested.
Oh,
that's
yeah, the operation of ground fault circuit interrupters.
Will you show the original standard up there?
Yeah, I feel that...
I think you passed it.
Observing...
What is it?
Observing...
Yeah.
Observing
operation.
Right.
Yep.
There
you go. Operation of ground fault circuit interrupters.
Yeah, that stuff about 6 feet of interior plumbing and all...
No, we want that out.
That's a discussion for another day. But some of that... verbiage I don't like.
I'm sorry, Simo, what verbiage you didn't like?
It says about 6 feet from
yeah, right. Water sources. That's leaving.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, it's struck. Okay. But testing the GFIs, I feel test. I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years. You know, testing.
Are you in the
GFIs.
Knot?
Huh?
Not, I'm sorry, Roger. I was talking to Kurt. Are you in the is not required?
No. This is a trick.
No. Shall. We are in the shell.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so you think the inspector should be continuing to test GFIs like they are today?
And disclaim if they can't find them. I mean, there's hundreds of garages out there. I never saw a GFI, mm-hmm. You know, so I disclaimed.
Okay. Right.
You see, the smart inspector is going to find the resets first.
Yeah, I'm a smart inspector. I do that.
Right. Before, yeah. But we got many that aren't, so they're going to have to learn. And I'm not a fan of dummying down home inspectors. I'm a fan of making them learn. And that's to me, ground faults are a very, very important issue in the house.
All right. I think we're going to end the discussion now. I want to thank you guys for jumping in on this. There are a few additional things, probably less contentious, to discuss. I will start... redrafting from these notes here today. I may send that, I don't know if it'd be too preliminary to send that off to you, Kurt. I guess I'm gonna have to do that. That would make the most sense. I'll redraft with the changes today, send it to you, and it'll be in the next meeting agenda.
Yeah.
And we'll have to try to finish it whenever we come back here, I guess.
Yeah, if you could have the minutes reflect that we lost our quorum was lost at whatever time, or whatever. We
you guys need to stand the meeting.
and then so the things that have to be on the next meeting agenda, we should at least put a future agenda list together.
Skip to that.
So do you want to return to 5A, the turn?
If you've lost your quorum, you can't hold a meeting.
They haven't yet.
Yeah, not yet, but they're...
Oh, okay, yeah, all right, okay.
We're discussing how to end it.
Yeah.
All right.
So do we want 5A in there, or is that staff going to notify us of that? Whatever we think on that.
That's the terms?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll expect staff to come back to us.
Yeah, so 5A needs to stay in, right, on clarifying terms?
Mm-hmm.
5A stays in.
5D.
B we decided. Do we need a motion on B?
No.
We can, but.
No, I think we clarified it.
Okay, so we'll just presume that's answered.
I think we addressed that.
C's got to come back, right?
Wait a minute.
C, we moved already to ask staff to revise and get
right,
back.
Right, so we need to look at that revision. So we're going to do it in between meetings.
No, it's got to be at a meeting, so we got to bring C back in.
So wouldn't B be better served with a motion, though?
I would err on the side of caution and just move to give direction to staff that a guest house, casita, and grandma flat cannot be considered separate residential dwelling units for the purposes of a parallel inspection.
Okay.
So moved?
I move.
All right, second. All right.
Third?
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so now we have a motion on Baker.
So C, we'll look for that revision. We may not have to review that again, or do we want to leave
so
that?
So leave D in there.
We'll bring it.
We'll bring C back. We'll bring D back.
And
E back.
I guess we need both E and F, right? I
don't know. We only got one thing done today.
We shouldn't. We
talked about a lot.
We don't need. We don't need F. We can't do a darn thing with F until until the rules are approved. We can't eliminate the substantive policy statement until it's already in rules.
So right, there was more than one statement other than the fog windows. There was one or two others that had to do with home inspectors, right?
So if you just want to incorporate anything into your...
Yeah, I didn't think there was anything else. I mean, the other one was more conduct related, having to do with
because it might be a rescinded one that you're thinking of already.
Conflicts of interest it was a conflict of interest.
That was rescinded at the last.
It didn't belong in the SOPs. That made sense. Had to do with advertising, conflicts of interest, and pay for play fees.
All that's been taken care of, hasn't it?
It has been.
Everything else is in order.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just trying to think of what other statements there were out there.
I thought the only one on the agenda today, but I looked again. And there was just that 5F.
Okay, that's all we have. Maybe that's it.
It has a full PDF as well.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yeah. We're tabling the director's report and the committee chairman's report.
We are tabling director's report and committee chair report.
And then do we want to set a proposed date in January or anything? Or?
Yes.
November, December. Yeah, we got to do it this quick.
Or, I don't know, December gets rough.
And the way this is shaping up on the home inspector's standards, we're going to need to clear our calendars for that meeting completely. All right, so let's think through this so that we can sit here and punch this out.
Well, yeah, I think we got through a chunk of it, though.
I'd like to believe
if we don't have a big other agenda, we could get it done in a two and a half hour meeting. I'd like to believe that.
Is there a day of the week that works better?
We used to always do Wednesdays. And then we used to always do Tuesdays.
Are you guys looking at December or January? Let's pick the month.
We generally don't meet in December.
And we generally don't.
The only time we come in here is for the Christmas party.
Yeah. Okay, so January.
Speaking of which, I know.
5th or 12th?
It's second or third week is what we're looking at. 11th or 18th, I'm going to go back to Tuesdays.
I think I could do the 5th, okay. Or,
eight. I don't know, you want first week of the month, first week of the year? I don't know about that, David. Maybe we should stay away from the first week.
12?
Takes a lot longer.
I could do the 12th.
12th is okay.
Yeah.
12th?
Yeah.
We'll try for January 12th here.
Okay.
Okay. And Paul, also keep copying me on your changes.
I will.
Okay, because
I will.
We are,
because you catch stuff that I miss.
And I just look for clerical is really important.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that we adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Sorry, who seconded that one?
This meeting is adjourned at, say, 12:15.
Paul seconded.
Paul seconded.